takes on a peculiar and bone-deep horror and disgust. It is both frightening and violating, like a sly, terrible burglar. A house askew is one of the not-rightest things in the world, and is terrible out of all proportion to its actual visitant. I came to write of a new house that was, let's say, malignant, for the very simple reason that I wanted to see if I could write a good ghost story. I was tired and rather simple-minded from a 2-year stint of heavy, serious, writery writing. Yet I wanted to be at work, and thought the ghost story would be fun. And as I was casting about in my mind for a good hook or handle, a young architect bought the lovely wooded lot next to our house and began to build a contemporary house on it. My writing room, upstairs under the eaves of our old house, looks right into the lot next door, and I would sit and stare dreamily out my window and watch the wild woods and hills go down and the house go up. And one day the inevitable "what if" that starts all writers' writing bloomed in my mind, and we were off. What if, I thought, instead of an ancient haunted priory on the coast of Cornwall, or a pre-revolutionary farmhouse in Bucks County with a visitant or two, or even the ruins of an antebellum plantation house with a hoop-skirted specter wailing around the desecrated chimney for her lost world, you had a brand-new contemporary going up in an affluent suburb of a large city. You'd expect the priory and the farmhouse and the plantation to be haunted, but the contemporary? Wouldn't that give it an even meaner, nastier little fillip? Serve to emphasize by contrast and horror? I thought it would. I'm still not sure how I arrived at the idea that the house would use its sheer loveliness to attract people, and then begin to turn their own deepest weaknesses, their soft spots, against them. It seems to me that in this day of pragmatists and materialists, a conventional specter would be almost laughable. In the suburb that I envisioned, the people do not believe in that sort of thing. It is almost improper. A traditional ghoulie would be laughed out of the neighborhood. So what would get to my quasi-sophisticated suburbanite? What would break relationships and crumble defenses and penetrate suburban armors? It would have to be different in each case. Each person has his own built-in horror button. Let's have a house that can isolate and push it, and then you've really got a case of the suburban willies. The plot of the book emerged in one typewriter sitting, almost whole and in infinite detail, as though it had been there all along just waiting to be uncovered. The house next door was plotted and whole in a day. From there it looked to be great fun, and I set off on it with a light heart, because I thought it would be an easy book to write. And in a sense, it was. These are my people. I am of this world. I know them from the skin out. They were, of course, caricatures in most cases. Most of the people I know are, thankfully, far more eccentric and not so determinedly suburban as this set of folks. But I needed them to be the way they were to make a point, and I found the limning of them went like greased lightning. Because the whole point of this book, of course, is not so much the house and its peculiar, terrible power, but what effect it has on the neighborhood, and on the relationships between neighbors and friends, and between families, when they are forced to confront and believe the unbelievable. This has always been the power of the supernatural to me, that it blasts and breaks relationships between people and other people, and between people and their world, and, in a way, between people and the very essences of themselves. And the blasting and breaking leaves them defenseless and alone, howling in terror before the thing that they have been forced to believe. For belief is everything. Belief is all. Without belief, there is no terror. And I think it is even more terrible when a modern man or woman, girded round with privilege and education and all the trappings of the so-called good life, and all the freight of the clever, pragmatic, vision-hungry modern mind, is forced to confront utter, alien, and elemental evil and terror. What does he know of this? What has it got to do with him? What has the unspeakable and the unbelievable got to do with second homes and tax shelters and private schools for the kids and a pate in every tureen and a BMW in every garage? Primitive man might howl before his returning dead and point. His neighbor would see and howl along with him. The resident of Fox Run Chase who meets a ghoulie out by the hot tub is going to be frozen dead in his or her Nikes on the tennis courts the next day if he or she persists in gabbling about it. And there he is, alone with the horror and ostracized on all sides. It's a double turn of the screw, and I thought it would make a good story. I still think it did. I think it holds up well. But it is only now that I am able to read the book with any equanimity. About a third of the way through it, the writing ceased to be fun and became something as oppressive to me as it was obsessive. I realized I was into something vast and terrible, and not at all funny. I was hurting and destroying people, or allowing them to be hurt and destroyed, which amounts to the same thing. There is in me some leftover streak of Puritan ethic or squinty-eyed Calvinistic morality that insists that things must have a point. I dislike anything gratuitous. Evil must not be allowed to get away unpunished, even though I know that it does every day. Ultimately, there must be a day of reckoning for the bad thing, and I still have no idea if this is a strength or weakness. It certainly does not lend itself to subtleties, but I do not see myself as a clever writer, and so the house next door became very serious business indeed to me. I knew that Colquitt and Walter Kennedy, whom I really liked very much indeed, would be destroyed by the house, they in turn destroyed at the end of the book. But to me there was very real gallantry in the fact that they knew this themselves, and went ahead anyway. I was glad they did not run away. I would hope that, faced with something as overwhelmingly vast and terrible, and left with so few options, I would have the grace and courage to do as they did. I speak of them as though they were outside my control, because I feel as if they are, and most of the way through the book I felt this. There is an inevitability about the outcome. That, to me, was inherent even on the first page of the book. It happened this way because this is the way it would have happened in this time and this place to these people. That is a satisfying feeling to me, and it is not one that I have had about all my books, and so in that sense I feel that it succeeds. On its simplest level, I think it works well as a piece of horror fiction that depends on the juxtaposition of the unimaginably terrible with the utterly ordinary, the wonderful Henry James terror in sunlight syndrome. Rosemary's Baby is the absolute master of this particular device, and it was that quality in part that I strove for. I also feel good about the fact that, to me, all the characters are still extremely sympathetic people, even this long after writing, and after this many re-readings. I cared very much what happened to them as I unveiled them on the pages, and I still care about them. Maybe it succeeds, too, in being an utterly contemporary horror tale. Maybe this is the wave of the future. It isn't the thing that goes bump in your house in the night that is going to do you in this brave new world. It's your house itself. In a world where the very furniture of your life, the basic bones of your existence, turn terrible and strange, perhaps the only thing we're going to have to fall back on is whatever innate decency we can find deep within ourselves. In a way, I do not think this is a bad thing. A phrase that stands out in Citizen's analysis of her own work, at least it stands out to me, is this one. To me, there was very real gallantry, she says, in the fact that they knew this themselves and went ahead anyway. We might think of this as a uniquely Southern sentiment, and as ladylike as she is, Ann Rivers Siddons is squarely in a Southern tradition of Gothic writers. She tells us she has jettisoned the ruins of the antebellum plantation, and so she has, but in a wider sense, the house next door is very much the same spooky tumble-down plantation home, where writers as seemingly disparate, but as essentially similar as William Faulkner, Harry Cruse, and Flannery O'Connor, probably the greatest American short story writer of the post-war era, have lived before her. It is a home where even such a really gruesomely bad writer as William Bradford Huey has rented space from time to time. If the Southern experience were to be viewed as untilled soil, then we would have to say that almost any writer, no matter how good or bad, who deeply feels that Southern experience could plant a seed and have it grow, as an example I recommend Thomas Cullinan's novel The Beguiled, made into a good Clint Eastwood film, directed by Don Siegel. Here is a novel which is written pretty good, as a friend of mine likes to put it, meaning, of course, nothing special. No Saul Bellow, no Bernard Malamud, but at least not down there in steerage with people like Harold Robbins and Sidney Sheldon, who apparently wouldn't know the difference between a balanced line of prose and a shitting anchovy pizza. If Cullinan had elected to write a more conventional novel, it would stick out in no one's mind. Instead, he came up with this mad gothic tale about a Union soldier who loses his legs and then his life to the deadly Angels of Mercy who dwell in a ruined girls' school that has been left behind in Sherman's march to the sea. This is Cullinan's little acre of that patch of untilled soil, soil which has always been amazingly rich. One is tempted to believe that outside of the South, such an idea wouldn't raise much more than ragweed. But in this soil, it grows a vine of potent, crazed beauty. The reader is mesmerized with horror by what goes on in that forgotten school for young ladies. On the other hand, William Faulkner did more than drop a few seeds. He planted the whole damn garden, and everything he turned his hand to after 1930, when he really discovered the Gothic form for fair, seemed to come up. The essence of the Southern Gothic in Faulkner's work comes, for me, in Sanctuary, when Popeye stands on the scaffold, about to be hanged. He has combed his hair neatly for the occasion, but now, with the rope around his neck and his hands tied behind his back, his hair has fallen lankly across his forehead. He begins to jerk his head, trying to flip his hair back into place. "I'll fix that for you," the executioner tells him, and pulls the trigger on the scaffold's trap door. Exit Popeye, with hair in his face. I believe with all my heart that no one brought up north of the Mason-Dixon line could have thought of that scene, or written it right, if he or she had done. Ditto the long, lurid, and excruciating scene in the doctor's waiting room which opens Flannery O'Connor's novella Revelation. There are no doctor's waiting rooms like that outside the Southern imagination. Holy Jesus, what a crew! My point is that there is something frighteningly lush and fertile in the Southern imagination, and this seems particularly so when it turns into the Gothic channel. The case of the Harrelsons, the first family to inhabit the bad place in Siddons' novel, shows quite clearly how the author has put her own Southern Gothic imagination to work. Pi Harrelson, the girl wife Chi Omega Junior Leaguer, wields an unhealthy sort of attraction over her father, a beefy, choleric man from the wiregrass South. Pi seems quite aware that her husband, Buddy, makes a triangle, with her at the apex and Daddy at one of the lower corners. She plays the two of them off one another. The house itself is only another pawn in the love-hate-love affairs she seems to be having with her father. "That weird thing she has with him," one character says dismissively. Near the end of her first conversation with Colquitt and Walter, Pi says gleefully, "Oh, Daddy's just going to hate this house. Oh, he's going to be fit to be tied." Buddy, meanwhile, has been taken under the wing of Lucas Abbott, a new arrival at the law office where Buddy works. Abbott is a northerner, and we hear passingly that Abbott left New York as the result of a scandal, something about a law clerk. The house next door, which turns people's own deepest weaknesses against them, as Siddons says, fuses these elements neatly and horribly. Near the end of the housewarming party, Pi begins to scream. The guests rush to see what has happened to her. They find Buddy Harrelson and Lucas Abbott embracing, naked, in the bedroom where the coats have been left. Pi's daddy has found them first, and he is in the process of expiring of a stroke on the floor while his pumpkin pie screams on and on and on. Now, that isn't Southern Gothic. What is? The essence of the horror in this scene, which for some reason reminds me strongly of that heart-stopping moment in Rebecca, where the nameless narrator stops the party cold by floating down the stairs in the costume also worn by Maxim's dreadful first wife, lies in the fact that social codes have not merely been breached, they have been exploded in our shocked faces. Siddons pulls this particular dynamite blast off perfectly. It is a case of everything going just about as totally wrong as things can go. Lives and careers are ruined irrevocably in a passage of seconds. We need not analyze the psyche of the horror writer. Nothing is so boring or so annoying as people who ask things like, "Why are you so weird?" or "Was your mother scared by a two-headed dog while you were in utero?" Nor am I going to do that here. but I'll point out that much of the walloping effect of The House Next Door comes from its author's nice grasp of social boundaries. Any writer of the horror tale has a clear, perhaps even a morbidly overdeveloped, conception of where the country of the socially, or morally, or psychologically, acceptable ends and that great white space of taboo begins. Siddons is better at marking the edges of the socially acceptable from the socially nightmarish than most, although Daphne du Maurier comes to mind again, and I'll bet that she was taught young that you don't eat with your elbows on the table, or make abnormal love in the coat room. She returns to the breach of social codes again and again, as she does in an earlier non-supernatural novel about the South, Heartbreak Hotel, and on its most rational, symbolic level, The House Next Door can be read as a funny, horrible sociological treatise on the mores and folkways of the modestly suburban rich. But beneath this, the heart of the Southern Gothic beats strongly. Colquitt tells us she could not bear to tell her closest friend what she saw on the day when Anita Sheehan finally and irrevocably lost her mind, but she is able to tell us in vivid, shocking detail. Horrified or not, Colquitt saw it all. She herself makes a New South, Old South comparison near the beginning of the novel, and the novel, taken as a whole, is another. On the surface, we see the obligatory tobacco-browned Mercedeses, vacations at Ocorrios, Bloody Marys sprinkled thickly with fresh dill at Rinaldi's, but the stuff underneath, the stuff which makes the heart of this novel pulse with such a tremendous crude strength, is the Old South, the Southern Gothic stuff. Underneath, The House Next Door is not situated in a Tony Atlanta suburb at all. It is located in that grimly grotty country of the heart that Flannery O'Connor mapped so well. Scratch Colquitt Kennedy deeply enough, and we find O'Connor's Mrs. Turpin standing in her pig pen and waiting for a revelation. If the book has a serious problem, it lies in our perception of Walter, Colquitt, and the third major character, Virginia Guthrie. Our feelings about these characters are not particularly sympathetic, and while it is not a rule that they should be, the reader may find it hard to understand why Siddons likes them, as she says she does. Through most of the book, Colquitt herself is particularly unappetizing, vain, class-conscious, money-conscious, sexually priggish, and vaguely exhibitionist at the same time. "We like our lives and our possessions to run smoothly," she tells the reader with a maddening complacency early on. "Chaos, violence, disorder, mindlessness all upset us. They do not frighten us precisely because we are aware of them. We watch the news. We are active in our own brand of rather liberal politics. We know we have built a shell for ourselves, but we have worked hard for the means to do it. We have chosen it. Surely we have the right to do that." In all fairness, part of this is meant to set us up for the changes that Colquitt and Walter undergo as a result of the supernatural didos next door. That damned house is doing what Bob Dylan called bringing it all back home. Siddons undoubtedly means to tell us that the Kennedys eventually arrive at a new plateau of social consciousness. After the episode with the Sheehans, Colquitt tells her husband, "You know, Walter, we've never stuck our necks out. We've never put ourselves or anything we really value on the line. We've taken the best life has to give, and we really haven't given anything back." If this is so, then Siddons succeeds. The Kennedys pay with their lives. The novel's problem may be that the reader is apt to feel that the dues paid were fair ones. Siddons' own view on just what the Kennedys' rising social consciousness means is also muddier than I would like. If it is a victory, it seems to be of the Pyrrhic variety. Their world has been destroyed by their conviction that they must warn the world against the house next door, but their conviction seems to have given them remarkably little inner peace in return, and the book's kicker seems to indicate that their victory has a decidedly hollow ring. Colquitt does not just put on her sun hat when she goes out to do the garden. She puts on her Mexican sun hat. She is justly proud of her job, but the reader may feel a bit more uneasy about her serene confidence in her own looks. "I have what I want, and do not need the adulation of a young man, even though, I modestly admit, there have been some around my agency who have offered it." We know that she looks good in tight jeans. Colquitt herself helpfully points this out. We have the feeling that if the book had been written a year or two later, Colquitt would be pointing out that she looks good in her Calvin Klein jeans. The point of all this is that she's not a character most people will be able to hope for easily, and whether or not her personal tics help or hinder in the book's steady, down-turning funnel toward disaster is something that the reader will have to decide for herself or himself. Equally problematic is the book's dialogue. At one point, Colquitt hugs the newly arrived Anita Sheehan and tells her, "Welcome to the neighborhood once again, Anita Sheehan, because you're a whole new lady and one I like immensely, and I hope you're going to be very, very happy here." I don't quibble with the sentiment. I just wonder if people, even in the South, really talk like this. Let's say this. The major problem with The House Next Door is the muddiness of character development. A lesser problem is one of actual execution, a problem that crops up mostly in the dialogue, as the narration is adequate and the imagery often oddly beautiful. But as a Gothic, the book succeeds admirably. Now let me suggest that, in addition to being a Southern Gothic novel, Anne Rivers Siddons' The House Next Door, whatever its shortcomings in terms of characterization or execution, succeeds on far more important ground. It is a prime example of what Irving Malan calls the New American Gothic. So is Straub's Ghost Story, for that matter, although Straub seems much more clearly aware of the species of fish he has netted. The clearest indication of this is his use of the Narcissus myth and the spooky use of the lethal mirror. John G. Park employed Malan's idea of the New American Gothic in an article for Critique, Studies in Modern Fiction. The article is Waiting for the End, Shirley Jackson's The Sundial by John G. Park, Critique, Volume 19, Number 3, 1978. Park's article is on Shirley Jackson's novel The Sundial, but what he says about that book is equally applicable to a whole slew of American ghost and horror stories, including several of my own. Here is Malan's list of ingredients for the modern Gothic, as explained by Park in his article. First, a microcosm serves as the arena where universal forces collide. In the case of the Siddons book, The House Next Door serves as this microcosm. Second, the Gothic house functions as an image of authoritarianism, of imprisonment, or of confining narcissism. By narcissism, Park and Malan seem to mean a growing obsession with one's own problems, a turning inward instead of a growing outward. The New American Gothic provides a closed loop of character, and in what might be termed a psychological pathetic fallacy, the physical surroundings often mimic the inward turning of the characters themselves, as they do in The Sundial. Or in The Shining, which was written with The Sundial very much in mind. In The Shining, the characters are snowbound and isolated in an old hotel miles from any help. Their world has shrunk and turned inward. The Overlook Hotel becomes the microcosm where universal forces collide, and the inner weather mimics the outer weather. Critics of Stanley Kubrick's film version would do well to remember that it was these elements, consciously or unconsciously, which Kubrick chose to accentuate. This is an exciting, even fundamental change in the intent of the Gothic. Once upon a time, the Bad Place was seen by critics as symbolic of the womb, a primarily sexual symbol, which perhaps allowed the Gothic to become a safe way of talking about sexual fears. Park and Malan are suggesting that the New American Gothic, created primarily in the 20 or so years since Shirley Jackson published The Haunting of Hill House, uses the Bad Place not to symbolize sexual interests and fear of sex, but interest in the self and fear of the self. And if anyone should ever ask you why there has been such a bulge in the popularity of horror fiction and horror films over the last 5 years or so, you might point out to your questioner that the rise of the horror film in the 70s and early 80s and the rise of such things as rolfing, primal screaming, and hot tubbing run pretty much in tandem, and that most of the really popular examples of the horror genre, from The Exorcist to Cronenberg's They Came From Within, are fine examples of the New American Gothic, where we have, instead of a symbolic womb, a symbolic mirror. This may sound like a lot of academic bullshit, but it's really not. The purpose of horror fiction is not only to explore taboo lands, but to confirm our own good feelings about the status quo by showing us extravagant visions of what the alternative might be. Like the scariest bad dreams, the good creep show often does its work by turning the status quo inside out. What scares us the most about Mr. Hyde, perhaps, is the fact that he was a part of Dr. Jekyll all along. And in an American society that has become more and more entranced by the cult of me-ism, it should not be surprising that the horror genre has turned more and more to trying to show us a reflection we won't like, our own. While looking at the house next door, we find we can lay the tarot card of the ghost aside. There are no ghosts, per se, in the house which is owned by the Harrelsons, the Sheehans, and the Greens. The card which seems to fit better here is the card that always seems to come up when we deal with narcissism, the card of the werewolf. More traditional werewolf stories almost always, knowingly or unknowingly, mimic the classic story of Narcissus. In the Lon Chaney Jr. version, we observe Chaney observing himself in the ever-popular pool of water as he undergoes the transformation back from Monster to Larry Talbot. We see the exact same scene occur in the original TV film of The Incredible Hulk, as the Hulk returns to his David Banner form. In Hammer's Curse of the Werewolf, the scene is repeated yet again, only this time it's Oliver Reed who's watching himself undergo the change. The real problem with the house next door, we see, is that it changes people into the very things they most abhor. The real secret of the house next door is that it is a dressing room for werewolves. Nearly all the characters of the new American Gothic are narcissistic, Park sums up, in one form or another, weaklings who try to read their own preoccupations into reality. This sums up Colquitt Kennedy, I think, and it also sums up Eleanor, the protagonist of Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House. And Eleanor Vance is surely the finest character to come out of this new American Gothic tradition. The inspiration to write a ghost story, Lenny Maya Friedman writes in her study of Jackson's work, came to Miss Jackson as she was reading a book about a group of 19th-century psychic researchers who rented a haunted house in order to study it and record their impressions of what they had seen and heard for the purpose of presenting a treatise to the Society for Psychic Research. As she recalls, they thought they were being terribly scientific and proving all kinds of things, and yet the story that kept coming through their dry reports was not at all the story of a haunted house. It was the story of several earnest, I believe misguided, certainly determined people, with their differing motivations and backgrounds. The story so excited her that she could hardly wait to create her own haunted house and her own people to study it. Shortly thereafter, she states, on a trip to New York, she saw at the 125th Street station a grotesque house, one so evil-looking, one that made such a somber impression that she had nightmares about it long afterward. In response to her curiosity, a New York friend investigated and found that the house, intact from the front, was merely a shell since a fire had gutted the structure. In the meantime, she was searching newspapers, magazines, and books for pictures of suitably haunted-looking houses. And at last, she discovered a magazine picture of a house that seemed just right. It looked very much like the hideous building she had seen in New York. It had the same air of disease and decay, and if ever a house looked like a candidate for a ghost, it was this one. The picture identified the house as being in a California town. Consequently, hoping her mother in California might be able to acquire some information about the house, she wrote asking for help. As it happened, her mother was not only familiar with the house, but provided the startling information that Miss Jackson's great-grandfather had built it. From Shirley Jackson, by Lenny Maya Friedman, Boston, Twain Publishers, 1975, page 121. Miss Friedman quotes directly from Shirley Jackson's account of how the book came to be. Miss Jackson's account was published in an article entitled Experience and Fiction. As the crypt keeper used to say. On its simplest level, Hill House follows the plan of those psychic society investigators of whom Miss Jackson had read. It is a tale of four ghostbusters who gather in a house of ill repute. It recounts their adventures there and culminates with a scary, mystifying climax. The ghostbusters, Eleanor, Theo, and Luke, have come together under the auspices of one Dr. Montague, an anthropologist whose hobby is investigating psychic phenomena. Luke, a young, wise guy type of fellow, memorably played by Rust Hamblin in Robert Wise's sensitive film version of the book, is there as a representative of the owner, his aunt. He regards the whole thing as a lark, at least at first. Eleanor and Theo have been invited for different reasons. Montague has combed the back files of several psychic societies and has sent invitations to a fairly large number of people who have been involved with abnormal events in the past. The invitations, of course, suggest that these special people might enjoy summering with Montague at Hill House. Eleanor and Theo are the only two to respond, each for her own reasons. Theo, who has demonstrated a fairly convincing ability with the Rhine cards, is on the outs with her current lover. In the film, Theo, played by Claire Bloom, is presented as a lesbian with a lech for Eleanor. In Jackson's novel, there is the barest whiff that Theo's sexual preferences may not be 100% AC. But it is Eleanor, on whose house stones fell when she was a little girl, that the novel is vitally concerned with, and it is the character of Eleanor and Shirley Jackson's depiction of it that elevates The Haunting of Hill House into the ranks of the great supernatural novels. Indeed, it seems to me that it and James's The Turn of the Screw are the only two great novels of the supernatural in the last 100 years, although we might add two long novellas, Machen's The Great God Pan and Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness. Nearly all the characters of the new American Gothic are narcissistic, weaklings who try to read their own preoccupations into reality. Try this shoe on Eleanor and we find it fits perfectly. She is obsessively concerned with herself, and in Hill House she finds a huge and monstrous mirror reflecting back her own distorted face. She is a woman who has been profoundly stunted by her upbringing and her family life. When we are inside her mind, which is almost constantly, with the exception of the first chapter and the last, we may find ourselves thinking of that old Oriental custom of foot-binding. Only it is not Eleanor's feet that have been bound. It is that part of her mind where the ability to live any sort of independent life must begin. It is true that Eleanor's characterization is one of the finest in Miss Jackson's works. Lenny Maya Friedman writes, "It is second only to that of Merricat in the later novel We Have Always Lived in the Castle. There are many facets to Eleanor's personality. She can be gay, charming, and witty when she feels wanted. She is generous and willing to give of herself. At the same time, she resents Theo's selfishness and is ready to accuse Theo of trickery when they discover the sign on the wall. For many years, Eleanor has been filled with frustration and hate. She has come to hate her mother, and then finally her sister and brother-in-law, for taking advantage of her more submissive and passive nature. She struggles to overcome the guilt she feels for the death of her mother. Although one comes to know her quite well, she remains mysterious. The mystery is a product of Eleanor's uncertainty and her mental and emotional changes, which are difficult to fathom. She is insecure and, therefore, unstable in her relationships with others and her relationship to the house. She feels the irresistible force of the spirits and longs, finally, to submit to them. When she does decide not to leave Hill House, one must assume she is slipping into madness." Friedman, Shirley Jackson, page 133. Hill House, then, is the microcosm where universal forces collide, and in his piece on The Sundial, published in 1958, a year before The Haunting of Hill House, John G. Park goes on to speak of the voyage, the attempt to flee, an attempt to escape, cloying authoritarianism. This is, in fact, the place where Eleanor's own voyage begins, and also the motive for that voyage. She is shy, withdrawn, and submissive. The mother has died, and Eleanor has judged and found herself guilty of negligence, perhaps even murder. She has remained firmly under the thumb of her married sister following her mother's death, and early on there is a bitter argument over whether Eleanor will be allowed to go to Hill House at all. And Eleanor, who is 32, habitually claims to be 2 years older. She does manage to get out, practically stealing the car which she has helped to purchase. The jailbreak is on, Eleanor's attempt to escape what Park calls cloying authoritarianism. The journey will lead her to Hill House, and as Eleanor herself thinks, with a growing feverish intensity as the story progresses, Journeys End in Lovers' Meeting. Her narcissism is perhaps most strikingly established by a fantasy she indulges in while still on the way to Hill House. She stops the car, full of disbelief and wonder, at the sight of a gate flanked by ruined stone pillars in the middle of a long line of oleanders. Eleanor recalls that oleanders are poisonous, and then, "Will I," she thought, "will I get out of my car and go between the ruined gates, and then, once I am in the magic oleander square, find that I have wandered into a fairyland, protected poisonously from the eyes of people passing? Once I have stepped between the magic gateposts, will I find myself through the protective barrier, the spell broken? I will go into a sweet garden, with fountains and low benches and roses trained over arbors, and find one path, jeweled perhaps, with rubies and emeralds, soft enough for a king's daughter to walk upon with her little sandaled feet, and it will lead me directly to the palace, which lies under a spell. I will walk up low stone steps, past stone lions guarding, and into a courtyard where a fountain plays, and the queen waits, weeping, for the princess to return. And we shall live happily ever after." The depth of this sudden fantasy is meant to startle us, and it does. It suggests a personality to which fantasizing has become a way of life, and what happens to Eleanor at Hill House comes uncomfortably close to fulfilling this strange fantasy dream, perhaps even the happily ever after part, although I suspect Shirley Jackson would doubt that. More than anything, the passage indicates the unsettling, perhaps mad depths of Eleanor's narcissism. Weird home movies play constantly inside her head, movies of which she is the star and the sole moving force, movies which are the exact opposite of her real life, in fact. Her imagination is restless, fertile, and perhaps dangerous. Later, the stone lions she has imagined in the passage quoted turn up as ornamental bookends in the totally fictional apartment she has imagined for Theo's benefit. In Eleanor's life, that turning inward, which Park and Malin associate with the new American Gothic, is a constant thing. Shortly after the Enchanted Castle fantasy, Eleanor stops for lunch and overhears a mother explaining to a waitress why her little girl will not drink her milk. "She wants her cup of stars," the mother says. "It has stars in the bottom, and she always drinks her milk from it at home. She calls it her cup of stars because she can see the stars while she drinks her milk." Eleanor immediately turns this into herself. "Indeed, yes," Eleanor thought. "Indeed, so do I. A cup of stars, of course." Like Narcissus himself, she is quite unable to deal with the outside world in any other way than as a reflection of her inner world. The weather in both places is always the same. But leave Eleanor for the time being, making her way toward Hill House, which always waits at the end of the day. We'll beat her there, if that's okay with you. I said that the house next door forms a provenance in its entirety. The provenance of Hill House is established in classic ghost story fashion by Dr. Montague in just 11 pages. The story is told, of course, by the fire, with drinks in hand. The salient points. Hill House was built by an unreconstructed Puritan named Hugh Crane. His young wife died moments before she would have seen Hill House for the first time. His second wife died of a fall, cause unknown. His two little girls remained in Hill House until the death of Crane's third wife. Nothing there, that wife died in Europe, and were then sent to a cousin. They spent the rest of their lives quarreling over the ownership of the mansion. Later, the older sister returns to Hill House with a companion, a young girl from the village. The companion becomes particularly important, because it is in her that Hill House seems most specifically to mirror Eleanor's own life. Eleanor, too, was a companion during her mother's long terminal illness. Following the death of old Miss Crane, there are stories of neglect, of a doctor called too late, Montague says, of the old lady lying neglected upstairs while the younger woman dallied in the garden with some village lout. More bitter feeling followed the death of the old Miss Crane. There was a court case over ownership between the companion and the young Miss Crane. The companion finally wins, and shortly after commits suicide by hanging herself in the turret. Later tenants have been, well, uncomfortable in Hill House. We have hints that some have been more than uncomfortable, that some of them may actually have fled from Hill House screaming in terror.
Essentially, Montague says, the evil is in the house itself, I think. It has enchanted and destroyed its people and their lives, and it is a place of contained ill will.
And the central question that The Haunting of Hill House poses for the reader is whether or not Montague is right. He prefaces his story with several classical references to what we've been calling the bad place, the Hebraic for haunted, as in haunted house, tesaras, meaning leprous. Homer's phrase for it, adiodomos, meaning a house of Hades.
I need not remind you, Montague says, that the concept of certain houses as unclean or forbidden, perhaps sacred, is as old as the mind of man.
As in the house next door, the one thing we can be sure of is that there are no actual ghosts in Hill House. None of the four characters come upon the shade of the companion flapping up the hall with a rope burn around her ectoplasmic neck. This is well enough, however. Montague himself says that in all the records of psychic phenomena, one cannot find any case where a ghost actually hurt a person. What they do if they are malign, he says, is work on the mind. One thing we do know about Hill House is that it is all wrong. It is no one thing we can put our finger on. It's everything. Stepping into Hill House is like stepping into the mind of a madman. It isn't long before you weird out yourself. No human eye can isolate the unhappy coincidence of line and place which suggests evil in the face of a house. And yet somehow a maniac juxtaposition, a badly turned angle, some chance meeting of roof and sky, turned Hill House into a place of despair. The face of Hill House seemed awake, with a watchfulness from the blank windows and a touch of glee in the eyebrow of a cornice. And even more chilling, more to the point, Eleanor shook herself, turning to see the room complete. It had an unbelievably faulty design which left it chillingly wrong in all its dimensions, so that the walls seemed always in one direction a fraction longer than the eye could endure, and in another direction a fraction less than the barest tolerable length. This is where they want me to sleep, Eleanor thought incredulously. What nightmares are waiting, shadowed in those high corners? What breath of mindless fear will drift across my mouth? And shook herself again. Really, she told herself. Really, Eleanor. We see a horror story developing here that Lovecraft would have embraced enthusiastically had he lived long enough to read it. It might even have taught the old Providence spook a thing or two. H.P.L. was struck by the horror of wrong geometry. He wrote frequently of non-Euclidean angles that tortured the eye and hurt the mind, and suggested other dimensions where the sum of a triangle's three corners might equal more or less than 180 degrees. Contemplating such things, he suggested, might be enough in itself to drive a man crazy. Nor was he far wrong. We know from various psychological experiments that when you tamper with a man or woman's perspective on their physical world, you tamper with what may actually be the fulcrum of the human mind. Other writers have dealt with this fascinating idea of perspective gone haywire. My own favorite is Joseph Payne Brennan's short story, Canavan's Backyard, where an antiquarian book dealer discovers that his weedy, ordinary backyard is much longer than it seems. It runs, in fact, all the way to the portholes of hell. In Charles L. Grant's The Hour of the Ox Run Dead, one of the main characters discovers he can no longer find the borders of the town where he has lived all his life. We see him crawling along the verge of the highway, looking for the way back in. Unsettling stuff. But Jackson handled the concept better than anyone, I think. certainly better than Lovecraft, who understood it, but apparently couldn't show it. Theo enters the bedroom she will share with Eleanor, looking incredulously at a stained-glass window, a decorative urn, the pattern in the carpet. There is nothing wrong with these things, taken one by one. It is just that when we add up the perceptual equivalent of their angles, we come out with a triangle where the sum of the corners equals a bit more, or a bit less, than 180 degrees. As Ann Rivers Siddons points out, everything in Hill House is skewed. There is nothing which is perfectly straight or perfectly level, which may be why doors keep swinging open or shut. And this idea of skew is important to Jackson's concept of the bad place because it heightens those feelings of altered perception. Being in Hill House is like tripping on a low-watt dosage of LSD, where everything seems strange and you feel you will begin to hallucinate at any time. But you never quite do. You just look incredulously at a stained-glass window, or a decorative urn, or the pattern on the carpet. Being in Hill House is like looking into one of those trick rooms where folks look big at one end and small at the other. Being in Hill House is like lying in bed in the dark on the night you went three drinks beyond your capacity, and feeling the bed begin to spin slowly around and around. Jackson suggests, always in her low, insinuating voice, this, along with the turn of the screw, may very well be where Peter Straub got the idea that the horror story works best when it is ambiguous and low-key and restrained. These things, quietly and rationally. She is never strident. It is just, she says, that being in Hill House does something fundamental and unpleasant to the screen of perception. This is what, she suggests, being in telepathic contact with a lunatic would be like. Hill House is evil. We'll accept Montague's postulate. But how responsible is Hill House for the phenomena which follow? There are knockings in the night, huge thunderings, rather, which terrify both Theo and Eleanor. Luke and Professor Montague attempt to track down a barking dog and get lost within a stone's throw of the house. Shades of Canavan the book dealer, Brennan's story predates The Haunting of Hill House, and Charles Grant's strange little town of Ox Run, Connecticut. Theo's clothes are splattered with some foul red substance. Red paint, Eleanor says. But her terror suggests a more sinister substance that later disappears. And written in the same red substance, first in the hall and then over the wardrobe where the ruined clothes have been hung, are these words, "Come home, Eleanor. Help, Eleanor. Come home, Eleanor." Here in this writing is where the lives of Eleanor and of this evil house, this bad place, become inextricably entwined. The house has singled her out. The house has chosen her. Or is it the other way around? Either way, Eleanor's idea that journeys end in lovers' meeting becomes ever more ominous. Theo, who has some telepathic ability, begins to suspect more and more that Eleanor herself is responsible for most of the manifestations. A kind of low-key tension has built up between the two women, ostensibly over Luke, with whom Eleanor has begun to fall in love, but it probably springs more deeply from Theo's intuition that not everything which is happening in Hill House is of Hill House. We know there has been an incident of telekinesis in Eleanor's past. At the age of 12, stones fell from the ceilings and pattered madly on the roof. She denies, hysterically denies, that she had anything at all to do with the incident of the stones, focusing instead on the embarrassment it caused her, the unwanted, she says it was unwanted anyway, attention that it brought upon her. Her denials have an odd effect upon the reader, one of increasing weight in light of the fact that most of the afferent phenomena which the four of them experience in Hill House could be ascribed either to poltergeists or to telekinetic phenomena. "They never even told me what was going on," Eleanor says urgently, even after the conversation has moved on from the episode of the stones. No one is even really listening to her. But in the closed circle of her own narcissistic world, it seems to her that this strange, long-ago phenomenon must be all they can think of, as it is all she can think of. The outer weather must reflect the inner weather. My mother said it was the neighbors. They were always against us because she wouldn't mix with them. My mother... Luke interrupts her to say, I think all we want here is the facts. But for Eleanor, the facts of her own life are all she can cope with. How responsible is Eleanor for the tragedy which ensues? Let's look again at the peculiar words the Ghostbusters find written in the hall. Help Eleanor, come home, Eleanor. The haunting of Hill House, submerged as it is in the twin ambiguities of Eleanor's personality and those of Hill House itself, becomes a novel that can be read in many different ways, a novel which suggests almost endless paths and a wide range of conclusions. Help Eleanor, for instance. If Eleanor herself is responsible for the writing, is she asking for help? If the house is responsible, is it asking her for help? Is Eleanor creating the ghost of her own mother? Is it mother who is calling for help? Or has Hill House probed Eleanor's mind and written something which will play on her gnawing sense of guilt? That long-ago companion, whom Eleanor so resembles, hanged herself after the house became hers, and guilt may well have been her motive. Is the house trying to do the same to Eleanor? In The House Next Door, this is exactly how the contemporary Kim Doherty has built, works on the minds of its tenants, probing for the weak points and preying on them. Hill House may be doing this alone. It may be doing it with Eleanor's help, or Eleanor may be doing it alone. The book is subtle, and the reader is left in large part to work these questions out to his or her own satisfaction. What about the rest of the phrase, "Come home, Eleanor"? Again, we may hear the voice of Eleanor's dead mother in this imperative, or the voice of her own central self crying out against this new independence, this attempt to escape Park's cloying authoritarianism, and into an exhilarating but existentially scary state of personal freedom. I see this as the most logical possibility. As Marquette tells us in Jackson's final novel that we have always lived in the castle, so Eleanor Vance has always lived in her own closed and suffocating world. It is not Hill House which frightens her, we feel. Hill House is another closed and suffocating world, walled in, cupped by hills, secure behind locked gates when the dark of night has fallen. The real threat, she seems to feel, comes from Montague, even more from Luke, and most of all from Theo. You've got foolishness and wickedness all mixed up, Theo tells Eleanor, after Eleanor has voiced her unease at painting her toenails red like Theo's. She simply tosses the line off, but such an idea strikes very close to the basis of Eleanor's most closely held life concepts. These people pose to Eleanor the possibility of another way of life, one which is largely anti-authoritarian and anti-narcissistic. Eleanor is attracted and yet repelled by the prospect. This is a woman who, at 32, feels daring when buying two pairs of slacks, after all. And it is not very daring of me to suggest that Come Home, Eleanor is an imperative Eleanor has delivered to herself, that she is Narcissus, unable to leave the pool. There is a third implication here, however, one which I find almost too horrifying to contemplate, and it is central to my own belief that this is one of the finest books ever to come out of the genre. Quite simply stated, Come Home, Eleanor may be Hill House's invitation for Eleanor to join it. Journey's end and lover's meeting is Eleanor's phrase for it, and as her end approaches, this old children's rhyme occurs to her. Go in and out the windows, go in and out the windows, go in and out the windows, as we have done before. Go forth and face your lover, go forth and face your lover, go forth and face your lover, as we have done before. Either way, Hill House or Eleanor as the central cause of the haunting, the ideas Park and Malin set forth hold up. Either Eleanor has succeeded, through her telekinetic ability, in turning Hill House into a giant mirror reflecting her own subconscious, or Hill House is a chameleon able to convince her that she has finally found her place, her own cup of stars, caught in these brooding hills. I believe that Shirley Jackson would like us to come away from her novel with the ultimate belief that it was Hill House all along. That first paragraph suggests outside evil very strongly. A primitive force, like that which inhabits Ann River Siddons' house next door, a force which is divorced from humankind. In Eleanor's end, we may feel that there are three layers of truth here. Eleanor's belief that the house is haunted, Eleanor's belief that the house is her place, that it has just been waiting for someone like her. Eleanor's final realization that she has been used by a monstrous organism, that she has, in fact, been manipulated on the subconscious level into believing that she has been pulling the strings. But it has all been done with mirrors, as the magicians say, and poor Eleanor is murdered by the ultimate falsehood of her own reflection in the brick and stone and glass of Hill House. "I am really doing it," she thought, turning the wheel to send the car directly at the great tree at the curve of the driveway. "I am really doing it. I am doing this all by myself, now, at last. This is me. I am really, really, really doing it by myself." In the unending, crashing second, before the car hurled into the tree, she thought clearly, "Why am I doing this? Why am I doing this? Why don't they stop me?" "I am doing this all by myself now, at last. This is me," Eleanor thinks. But of course, it is impossible for her to believe otherwise in the context of the new American Gothic. Her last thought before her death is not of Hill House, but of herself. The novel ends with a reprise of the first paragraph, closing the loop and completing the circuit, and leaving us with an unpleasant surmise. If Hill House was not haunted before, it certainly is now. Jackson finishes by telling us that whatever walked in Hill House walked alone. For Eleanor Vance, that would be business as usual. 4. A novel that makes a neat bridge away from the bad place, and perhaps it's time we got away from these haunted houses before we come down with the terminal case of the creeps, is Ira Levin's Rosemary's Baby, 1967. I used to be fond of telling people at the time Roman Polanski's film version came out that it was one of those rare cases where if you had read the book, you didn't have to see the movie, and if you had seen the movie, you didn't have to read the book. That is not really the truth. It never is. But Polanski's film version is remarkably true to Levin's novel, and both seem to share an ironic turn of humor. I don't believe anyone else could have made Levin's remarkable little novel quite so well. And by the way, while it is remarkable for Hollywood to remain so faithful to a novel, one sometimes thinks that major movie companies pay staggering sums for books just so they can tell their authors all the parts of them that don't work. Surely some of the most expensive ego-tripping in the history of American arts and letters. It is not remarkable in Levin's case. Every novel he has ever written has become a marvel of plotting. In case you're one of the 5 or 6 readers of popular fiction in America who has missed them, they are A Kiss Before Dying, Rosemary's Baby, This Perfect Day, The Stepford Wives, and The Boys from Brazil. He has written 2 Broadway plays, Veronica's Room and the immensely successful Death Trap. Less known is a modest but chillingly effective made-for-TV movie called Dr. Cook's Garden, starring Bing Crosby in a wonderfully adroit performance. He is the Swiss watchmaker of the suspense novel. In terms of plot, he makes what the rest of us do look like those $5 watches you can buy in the discount drugstores. This fact alone has made Levin almost invulnerable to the depredations of the story changers, those subverters who are more concerned with visual effect than with a coherent storyline. Levin's books are constructed as neatly as an elegant house of cards. Pull one plot twist, and everything comes tumbling down. As a result, movie makers have been pretty much forced to show us what Levin built. About the film, Levin himself says, "I've always felt that the film of Rosemary's Baby is the single most faithful adaptation of a novel ever to come out of Hollywood. Not only does it incorporate whole chunks of the book's dialogue, It even follows the colors of clothing, where I mention them, and the layout of the apartment. And perhaps more importantly, Polanski's directorial style of not aiming the camera squarely at the horror, but rather letting the audience spot it for themselves off at the side of the screen, coincides happily, I think, with my own writing style. There was a reason for his fidelity to the book, incidentally. His screenplay was the first adaptation he had written of someone else's material. His earlier films had all been originals. I think he didn't know it was permitted, nay, almost mandatory, to make changes. I remember him calling me from Hollywood to ask in which issue of the New Yorker Guy had seen the shirt advertised. To my chagrin, I had to admit I'd faked it. I had assumed any issue of the New Yorker would have a handsome shirt advertised in it, but the correct issue for the time of the scene didn't. Levin had written two horror novels, Rosemary's Baby and The Stepford Wives, and while both shine with the exquisite plotting that is Levin's trademark, probably neither is quite as effective as his first book, which is unfortunately not much read these days. A Kiss Before Dying is a gritty suspense story told with great elan. Rarity enough, but what is even more rare is that the book, written while Levin was in his early 20s, contains surprises which really surprise. And it is relatively impervious to that awful, dreadful goblin of a reader, he or she, who turns to the last three pages to see how it came out. Do you do this nasty, unworthy trick? Yes, you. I'm talking to you. Don't slink away and grin into your hand. Own up to it. Have you ever stood in a bookshop, glanced furtively around, and turned to the end of an Agatha Christie to see who did it, and how? Have you ever turned to the end of a horror novel to see if the hero made it out of the darkness and into the light? If you have ever done this, I have three simple words which I feel it is my duty to convey. Shame on you. It is low to mark your place in a book by folding down the corner of the page where you left off. Turning to the end to see how it came out is even lower. If you have this habit, I urge you to break it. Break it at once. I have always wanted to publish a novel with the last 30 pages simply left out. The reader would be mailed these final pages by the publisher upon receipt of a satisfactory summary of everything that had happened in the story up to that point. That would certainly put a spoke in the wheels of those people who turn to the end to see how it came out. Well, enough of this digression. All I intended to say about A Kiss Before Dying is that the book's biggest surprise, the real screeching bombshell, is neatly tucked away about 100 pages into the story. If you should happen upon this moment while thumbing randomly through the book, it means nothing to you. If you have read everything faithfully up to that point, it means everything. The only other writer I can think of offhand who had that wonderful ability to totally ambush the reader was the late Cornell Woolrich, who also wrote under the name of William Irish. But Woolrich did not have Levin's dry wit. Levin speaks affectionately of Woolrich as an influence on his own career, mentioning Phantom Lady and The Bride Wore Black as particular favorites. Levin's wit is probably a better place to start with Rosemary's Baby than his ability to plot a story. His output of novels has been relatively small. It averages out to one every 5 years or so. But it's interesting to note that one of the five, The Stepford Wives, works best as outright satire. William Goldman, the novelist screenwriter who adapted that book for the screen, knew it. You will remember that earlier on we mentioned, Oh, Frank, you're the best, you're the champ. Almost as farce, and Rosemary's Baby is a kind of socio-religious satire. We might also mention The Boys from Brazil, Levin's most recent novel, when we speak of his wit. The title itself is a pun, and although the book deals, even if only peripherally, with subjects such as the German death camps and the so-called scientific experiments that were carried out there, some of the scientific experiments, we will recall, included trying to impregnate women with the sperm of dogs and administering lethal doses of poison to identical twins in order to see if they would expire in a similar span of time. It vibrates with its own nervous wit and seems to parody those Martin Bormann is alive and well and living in Paraguay books that are apparently going to be with us even unto the end of the world. I am not suggesting that Ira Levin is either Jackie Vernon or George Orwell masquerading in a fright wig. Nothing so simple or simplistic. I am suggesting that the books he has written achieve suspense without turning into humorless thudding tracks, Two novels of the humorless, thudding tract school of horror writing are Damon by C. Terry Klein and The Exorcist by William Peter Blatty. Klein has since improved as a writer, and Blatty has fallen silent forever if we are lucky. Levin is one of the few writers who has returned more than once to the field of horror and the supernatural, and who seems unafraid of the fact that much of the material the genre deals with is utterly foolish. And at that, he has done better than many critics who visit the genre the way rich white ladies once visited the children of New England factory slaves on Thanksgiving with food baskets, and on Easter with chocolate eggs and bunnies. These slumming critics, unaware both of their own infuriating elitism and their total ignorance of what popular fiction does and what it is about, are able to see the foolishness spawned as a byproduct of the bubbling potions, the pointy black hats, and all the other clanking hugger-mugger trappings of the supernatural tale, but are unable to see, or refuse to see, the strong and universal archetypes that underlie the best of them. The foolishness is there, all right. This is Rosemary's first look at the child she has given birth to. His eyes were golden yellow, all golden yellow, with neither whites nor irises, all golden yellow, with vertical black-slit pupils. She looked at him. He looked at her, golden yellowly, and then at the swaying upside-down crucifix. She looked at them, watching her, and, knife in hand, screamed at them, "What have you done to his eyes?" They stirred and looked to Roman. "He has his father's eyes," he said. We have lived and suffered with Rosemary Woodhouse for 209 pages up to this point, and Roman Castevet's response to her question seems almost like the punchline of a long-involved shaggy dog story, one of the ones that ends with something like, "My, that's a long way to tip a rarey," or "Rudolph the Red knows reindeer." Besides yellow eyes, Rosemary's baby turns out to have claws. "They're very nice," Roman tells Rosemary. "Very tiny and pearly. The mitts are only so he doesn't scratch himself. And a tail, and the buds of horns." While I was teaching the book at the University of Maine to an undergraduate class entitled Themes in Horror and the Supernatural, one of my students mused that 10 years later, Rosemary's baby would be the only kid on his Little League team who needed a custom-tailored baseball cap. Basically, Rosemary has given birth to the comic book version of Satan, the little imp we were all familiar with as children, and who sometimes put in an appearance in the motion picture cartoons, arguing with a little angel over the main character's head. Levin broadens the satire by giving us a Satanist coven comprised almost entirely of old people. They argue constantly in their waspy voices about how the baby should be cared for. The fact that Laura Louise and Minnie Castevet are much too old to care for a baby somehow adds the final macabre touch, and Rosemary's first tentative bonding to her baby comes when she tells Laura Louise that she is rocking Andy much too fast, and that the wheels of his bassinet need to be oiled. Levin's accomplishment is that such satire does not deflate the horror of his story, but actually enhances it. Rosemary's baby is a splendid confirmation of the idea that humor and horror lie side by side, and that to deny one is to deny the other. It is a fact Joseph Heller makes splendid use of in Catch-22, and which Stanley Elkin used in The Living End, which might have been subtitled Job in the Afterlife. Besides satire, Levin laces his novel with veins of irony. "It's good for your blood, dearie," the old witch in the Easy Comics used to say. Early on, the Castevets invite Guy and Rosemary over for dinner. Rosemary accepts, on the condition that it won't be too much trouble.
"Honey, if it was trouble, I wouldn't ask you," Mrs. Castevet said. "Believe me, I'm as selfish as the day is long."
Rosemary smiled.
"That isn't what Terry told me," she said.
"Well," Mrs. Castevet said with a pleased smile, "Terry didn't know what she was talking about."
The irony is that everything Minnie Castevet says here is the literal truth. She really is as selfish as the day is long, and Terry, who ends up either being murdered or committing suicide when she discovers that she is to be or has been used as an incubator for Satan's child,
really didn't know what she was talking about. But she found out.
Oh, yes.
Hee-hee-hee.
My wife, raised in the Catholic Church, claims that the book is also a religious comedy with its own Shaggy Dog punchline. Rosemary's Baby, she claims, only proves what the Catholic Church has said about mixed marriages all along. They just don't work. This particular bit of comedy grows richer, perhaps, when we add the fact of Levin's own Jewishness against the Christian backdrop of custom used by the Satanist coven. Seen in this light, the book becomes a kind of you don't have to be Jewish to love Levy's view of the battle of good and evil.
Before leaving the idea of religion and talking a bit about the feelings of paranoia, which really seem to lie central to the book, let me suggest that while Levin's tongue is in his cheek, part of the time, that is no reason for us to expect it to be there all of the time. Rosemary's Baby was written and published at the time the God is Dead tempest was whirling around in the teapot of the 60s, and the book deals with questions of faith in an unpretentious but thoughtful and intriguing way. We might say that the major theme of Rosemary's Baby deals with urban paranoia, as opposed to the small town or rural paranoia we will see in Jack Finney's The Body Snatchers, but that an important minor theme could be stated along these lines. The weakening of religious conviction is an opening wedge for the devil, both in the macrocosm, questions of world faith, and in the microcosm, the cycle of Rosemary's faith as she goes from belief as Rosemary Riley to unbelief as Rosemary Woodhouse, to belief again as the mother of her infernal child. I'm not suggesting that Ira Levin believes this puritanical thesis, although he may, for all I know. I am suggesting, however, that it makes a nice fulcrum on which to turn his plot, and that he plays fair with the idea and explores most of its implications. In the religious pilgrim's progress that Rosemary goes through, Levin gives us a serio-comic allegory of faith. Rosemary and Guy begin as typical young marrieds. Rosemary is practicing birth control as a matter of course, in spite of her rigid Catholic upbringing. And both of them have decided they will have children only when they, not God, decide they are ready. After Terry's suicide, or was it murder, Rosemary has a dream in which she is being scolded by an old parochial schoolteacher, Sister Agnes, for bricking up the school windows and getting them disqualified from a beautiful school contest. But mingling with the dream are real voices from the Castavet apartment next door, and it is Minnie Castavet, speaking through the mouth of Sister Agnes in Rosemary's dream, that we are listening to.
"Anybody, anybody," Sister Agnes said. "All she has to be is young, healthy, and not a virgin. She doesn't have to be a no-good drug addict whore out of the gutter. Didn't I say that in the beginning? Anybody, as long as she's young and healthy and not a virgin."
This dream sequence does several useful things. It amuses us in a nervous, edgy sort of way. It lets us in on the fact that the Castavets were in some way involved in the death of Terry. It allows us to see shoaling waters ahead for Rosemary. Perhaps this is stuff that only interests another writer. It's more like two mechanics inspecting a nifty four-barrel carburetor than it is like classical analysis, but Levin does his job so unobtrusively that maybe it doesn't hurt for me to take the pointer and say, "Here, this is where he's starting to get close to you. This is the point of entry, and now he will begin working inward toward your heart." Yet the most significant thing about the passage is that Rosemary has woven a dream of Catholic intent around the words her lightly sleeping mind has overheard. She casts Minnie Castavet as a nun. And so she is, although she is a nun of a rather blacker persuasion than that long-ago Sister Agnes. My wife also says that one of the basic tenets of the Catholic Church she grew up with was, "Give us your children, and they will be ours forever." The shoe fits here, and Rosemary wears it. And ironically enough, it is the superficial weakening of her faith which allows the devil a doorway into her life. But it is the immutable bedrock of that same faith that allows her to accept Andy, horns and all. This is Levin's handling of religious views in the microcosm. On the surface, Rosemary is a typical young modern who could have stepped whole and breathing from Wallace Stevens's poem, Sunday Morning. The church bells mean nothing to her as she sits peeling her oranges.
But beneath, that parochial schoolgirl, Rosemary Riley, is very much there. His handling of the macrocosm is similar, just bigger. At the dinner party the Castevets have for the Woodhouses, conversation turns to the impending visit of the Pope to New York. "I tried to keep the book's unbelievabilities believable," Levin remarks, "by incorporating bits of real-life happenings along the way. I kept stacks of newspapers, and, writing about a month or two after the fact, worked in events such as the transit strike and Lindsay's election as mayor. When, having decided for obvious reasons that the baby should be born on June 25th, I checked back to see what had been happening on the night Rosemary would have to conceive. You know what I found? The Pope's visit and the Mass on television. Talk about serendipity! From then on, I felt the book was meant to be." The conversation between Guy Woodhouse and the Castevets concerning the Pope seems predictable, even banal, but it expresses the very view which Levin gently suggests is responsible for the whole thing.
"I heard on TV that he's going to postpone and wait until the newspaper strike is over," Mrs. Castevet said.
Guy smiled.
"Well," he said,
"that's showbiz."
Mr. and Mrs. Castevet laughed, and Guy along with them. Rosemary smiled and cut her steak. Still laughing, Mr. Castevet said,
"It is, you know. That's just what it is. Showbiz."
"You could say that again," Guy said.
"The costumes, the rituals,"
Mr. Castevet said.
"Every religion, not only Catholicism. Pageants for the ignorant."
Mrs. Castevet said,
"I think we're offending Rosemary."
"No, not at all," Rosemary said.
"You aren't religious, my dear, are you?"
Mr. Castevet asked.
"I was brought up to be," Rosemary said. "But now I'm an agnostic. I wasn't offended. Really, I wasn't."
We don't doubt the truth of Rosemary Woodhouse's statement. But underneath that surface, there is a little parochial schoolgirl named Rosemary Riley who is very offended, and who probably regards such talk as blasphemy. The Castevets are conducting a bizarre sort of job interview here, testing Rosemary and Guy for the depth and direction of their commitments and beliefs. They are revealing their own contempt for the church and things sacred, but, Levin suggests, they are also expressing views which are commonly held, and not just by Satanists. Yet faith must exist beneath, he suggests. It is the surface weakening that allows the devil in, but beneath, even the Castevets are in vital need of Christianity, because without the sacred, there is no profane. The Castevets seem to sense Rosemary Riley existing beneath Rosemary Woodhouse, and it is her husband Guy, an authentic pagan, that they use as a go-between. And Guy lowers himself admirably to the occasion. We are not allowed to doubt that it is the softening of Rosemary's faith that has given the devil a door into her life. Her sister Margaret, a good Catholic, calls Rosemary long distance, not long after the Castevet's plot has begun to move.
"I've had the funniest feeling all day long, Rosemary, that something happened to you, like an accident or something."
Rosemary isn't favored with such a premonition. The closest she gets is her dream of Sister Agnes, speaking in Minnie Castevet's voice, because she isn't worthy of it. Good Catholics, Levin says, and we may not sense his tongue creeping back into his cheek, get the good premonitions. The religious motif stretches through the book, and Levin does some clever things with it, but perhaps we could close off our discussion of it with some thoughts about Rosemary's remarkable conception dream. First, it is significant that the time chosen for the devil to impregnate Rosemary coincides with the Pope's visit. Rosemary's mousse is drugged, but she eats only a little of it. As a result, she has a dreamlike memory of her sexual encounter with the devil, but it is one her subconscious couches in symbolic terms. Reality flickers in and out as Guy prepares her for her confrontation with Satan. In her dream, Rosemary finds herself on a yacht with the assassinated President Kennedy. Jackie Kennedy, Pat Lawford, and Sarah Churchill are also in attendance. Rosemary asks JFK if her good friend Hutch, who becomes Rosemary's protector until he is struck down by the coven,
He is the one who warns Rosemary and Guy early on that Bramford is a bad place, is coming. Kennedy smiles and tells her the cruise is for Catholics only. This is one qualification Minnie has not mentioned earlier, but it helps confirm the idea that the person the coven is really interested in is Rosemary Riley. Again, it seems to be the blasphemy that they are mostly concerned with. The spiritual lineage of Christ must be perverted to allow them to accomplish a successful birth. Guy removes Rosemary's wedding ring, symbolically ending their marriage, but also becoming a kind of best man in reverse. Rosemary's friend Hutch comes with weather warnings, and what is a hutch anyway but a safe place for rabbits? During intercourse, Guy actually becomes the devil. In closing the dream out, we see Terry again, this time not as a failed bride of Satan, but as a sacrificial opener of the way. In less expert hands, such a dream scene might have become tiresome and didactic, but Levin carries it off lightly and quickly, compressing the entire sequence into just 5 pages. But the strongest watch spring of Rosemary's Baby isn't the religious sub-theme, but the book's use of urban paranoia. The conflict between Rosemary Riley and Rosemary Woodhouse enriches the story, but if the book achieves horror, and I think it does so because Levin is able to play upon these innate feelings of paranoia so skillfully. Horror is a groping for pressure points, and where are we any more vulnerable than in our feelings of paranoia? In many ways, Rosemary's Baby is like a sinister Woody Allen film, and the Woodhouse-Riley dichotomy is useful here too. Besides being a Catholic forever beneath her agnostic veneer, Rosemary is, beneath her carefully acquired cosmopolitan varnish, a small-town girl, and you can take the girl out of the country, but etc., etc. There is a saying, and I would be happy to attribute it, if I could remember who to attribute it to, that perfect paranoia is perfect awareness. In a crazy sort of way, Rosemary's story is of a coming to that sort of awareness. We become paranoid before she does. Minnie, for instance, being purposely slow with the dishes so Roman can talk to Guy, or make him a pitch in the other room. But following her dreamlike encounter with the devil and her subsequent pregnancy, her own paranoia follows along. When she wakes up the next morning, she finds scratches, as if from claws, all over her body. "Don't yell," Guy says, showing her his fingernails. "I already filed them down." Before long, Minnie and Roman have begun a campaign to get Rosemary to use their obstetrician, the famous Abe Saperstein, instead of the young guy she had been going to. "Don't do that, Rosemary," we want to tell her. "He's one of them." Modern psychiatry teaches us that there is no difference between us and the paranoid schizophrenic in Bedlam, except that we somehow manage to keep our crazier suspicions under control, while theirs have slipped their tethers. A story like Rosemary's Baby or Finney's The Body Snatchers seems to confirm the idea. We have discussed the horror story as a tale which derives this effect from our terror of things which depart the norm. We have looked at it as a taboo land which we enter with fear and trembling, and also as a Dionysian force which may invade our comfy Apollonian status quo without warning. Maybe all horror stories are really about disorder and the fear of change, and in Rosemary's Baby we have the feeling that everything is beginning to bulge at once. We can't see all the changes, but we sense them. Our dread for Rosemary springs from the fact that she seems the only normal person in a whole city of dangerous maniacs. Before we have reached the midpoint of Levin's tale, we suspect everybody. And in 9 cases out of 10, we have been right to do so. We are allowed to indulge our paranoia on Rosemary's behalf to the utmost, and all our nightmares come true. On my first reading of the book, I remember even suspecting Dr. Hill, the nice young obstetrician Rosemary has given up in favor of Dr. Saperstein. Of course, Hill is not a Satanist. He just gives Rosemary back to them when she comes to him for protection. If horror novels do serve as catharsis for more mundane fears, then Levin's Rosemary's Baby seems to reflect back and effectively use
the city dwellers' very real feelings of urban paranoia. In this book, there really are no nice people next door, and the worst things you ever imagined about that dotty old lady down in 9B turn out to be true. The real victory of the book is that it allows us to be crazy for a while. 5. From Urban Paranoia to Small Town Paranoia. Jack Finney's The Body Snatchers. As previously noted, the late 70s remake of the Finney novel resets the story in San Francisco, opting for an urban paranoia which results in a number of sequences strikingly like those which open Polanski's film version of Rosemary's Baby. But Philip Kaufman lost more than he gained, I think, by taking Finney's story out of its natural small town with a bandstand in the park setting. Finney himself has the following things to say about his book, which was originally published as a Dell paperback original in 1955. The book was written in the early 1950s, and I don't really remember a lot about it. I do recall that I simply felt in the mood to write something about a strange event or a series of them in a small town, something inexplicable, and that my first thought was that a dog would be injured or killed by a car, and it would be discovered that a part of the animal's skeleton was of stainless steel, bone and steel intermingled, that is, a thread of steel running into bone and bone into steel so that it was clear the two had grown together. But this idea led to nothing in my mind. I remember that I wrote the first chapter, pretty much as it appeared, if I am recalling correctly, in which people complained that someone close to them was in actuality an imposter. But I didn't know where this was to lead either. However, during the course of fooling around with this, trying to make it work out, I came across a reputable scientific theory that objects might in fact be pushed through space by the pressure of light, and that dormant life of some sort might conceivably drift through space, and this eventually worked the book out. I was never satisfied with my own explanation of how these dry, leaf-like objects came to resemble the people they imitated. It seemed, and seems, weak, but it was the best I could do. I have read explanations of the meaning of this story, which amuse me, because there is no meaning at all. It was just a story meant to entertain, and with no more meaning than that. The first movie version of the book followed the book with great faithfulness, except for the foolish ending, and I've always been amused by the contentions of people connected with the picture that they had a message of some sort in mind. If so, it's a lot more than I ever did, and since they followed my story very closely, it's hard to see how this message crept in. And when the message has been defined, it has always sounded a little simple-minded to me. The idea of writing a whole book in order to say that it's not really a good thing for us all to be alike, and that individuality is a good thing, makes me laugh. Nevertheless, Jack Finney has written a great deal of fiction about the idea that individuality is a good thing, and that conformity can start to get pretty scary after it passes a certain point. His comments, in a letter to me dated December 24, 1979, about the first film version of The Body Snatchers, raised a grin on my own face as well. As Pauline Kael, Penelope Gilliatt, and all of those sober-sighted film critics so often prove, no one is so humorless as a big-time film critic, or so apt to read deep meanings into simple doings. In The Fury, Pauline Kael intoned, apparently in all seriousness, Brian De Palma has found the junk heart of America. It is as if these critics feel it necessary to prove and reprove their own literacy. They are like teenage boys who feel obliged to demonstrate and redemonstrate their macho, perhaps most of all to themselves. This may be because they are working on the fringes of a field which deals entirely with pictures and the spoken word. They must surely be aware that while it requires at least a high school education to understand and appreciate all the facets of even such an accessible book as The Body Snatchers, any illiterate with $4 in his or her pocket can go to a movie and find the junk heart of America. Movies are merely picture books that talk, and this seems to have left many literate movie critics with acute feelings of inferiority. Filmmakers themselves are often happy to participate in this grotesque critical overkill, and I applauded Sam Peckinpah in my heart when he made this laconic reply to a critic who asked him why he had really made such a violent picture as the Wild Bunch.
"I like shoot-em-ups," or so he was reputed to have said. "And if it ain't true, gang, it ought to be."
The Don Siegel version of The Body Snatchers is an amusing case where the film critics tried to have it both ways. They began by saying that both Finney's novel and Siegel's film were allegories about the witch hunt atmosphere that accompanied the McCarthy hearings. Then Siegel himself spoke up and said that this film was really about the Red Menace. He did not go so far as to say that there was a commie under every American's bed, but there can be little doubt that Siegel at least believed he was making a movie about a creeping fifth column. It is the ultimate in paranoia, we might say. They're out there, and they look just like us. In the end, it's Finney who comes away sounding the most right. The Body Snatchers is just a good story, one to be read and savored for its own unique satisfactions. In the quarter century since its original publication as a humble paperback original, a shorter version appeared in Collier's, one of those good old magazines that fell by the wayside, in order to make space on the newsstands of America for such intellectual publications as Hustler, Screw, and Big Butts. The book has been rarely out of print. It reached its nadir as a photo novel in the wake of the Philip Kaufman remake. If there is a lower, slimier, more anti-book concept than the photo novel, I don't know what it would be. I think I'd rather see my kids reading a stack of Beeline books than one of those photo comics. It reached its zenith as a Gregg Press hardcover in 1976. Gregg Press is a small company which has reissued some 50 or 60 science fiction and fantasy books, novels, collections, and anthologies, originally published as paperbacks, in hardcover. The editors of the Gregg series, David Hartwell and L.W. Curry, have chosen wisely and well. And in the library of any reader who cares honestly about science fiction, and about books themselves as lovely artifacts, you're apt to find one or more of these distinctive green volumes with the red-gold stamping on the spines. Oh, dear God, we're off on another tangent. Well, never mind. I believe that what I started to say was simply that I think Finney's contention that The Body Snatchers is just a story is both right and wrong. My own belief about fiction, long and deeply held, is that story must be paramount over all other considerations in fiction. That story defines fiction, and that all other considerations, theme, mood, tone, symbol, style, even characterization, are expendable. There are critics who take the strongest possible exception to this view of fiction, and I really believe that they are the critics who would feel vastly more comfortable if Moby Dick were a doctoral thesis on cetology, rather than an account of what happened on the Pequod's final voyage. A doctoral thesis is what a million student papers have reduced this tale to, but the story still remains. This is what happened to Ishmael. As story still remains in Macbeth, The Fairy Queen, Pride and Prejudice, Jude the Obscure, The Great Gatsby, and Jack Finney's The Body Snatchers. And story, thank God, after a certain point, becomes irreducible, mysterious, impervious to analysis. You will find no English master's thesis in any college library titled The Story Elements of Melville's Moby Dick. And if you do find such a thesis, send it to me. I'll eat it with A1 steak sauce. All very fine. And yet I don't think Finney would argue with the idea that story values are determined by the mind through which they are filtered, and that the mind of any writer is a product of his outer world and inner temper. It is just the fact of this filter that has set the table for all those would-be English M.A.s, and I certainly would not want you to think that I begrudge them their degrees. God knows that as an English major I slung enough bullshit to fertilize most of East Texas, but a great number of the people who are sitting at the long and groaning table of graduate studies in English are cutting a lot of invisible steaks and roasts, not to mention trading the emperor's new clothes briskly back and forth in what may be the largest academic yard sale the world has ever seen. Still, what we have here is a Jack Finney novel, and we can say certain things about it simply because it is a Jack Finney novel. First, we can say that it will be grounded in absolute reality, a prosy reality that is almost humdrum, at least to begin with. When we first meet the book's hero, and here I think Finney probably would object if I used the more formal word protagonist, so I won't. Dr. Miles Bunnell. He is letting his last patient of the day out, a sprained thumb. Becky Driscoll enters. And how is that for the perfect all-American name? With the first off-key note. Her cousin Wilma has somehow gotten the idea that her Uncle Ira really isn't her uncle anymore. But this note is faint and barely audible under the simple melodies of small-town life that Finney plays so well in the book's opening chapters. And Finney's rendering of the small-town archetype in this book may be the best to come out of the 1950s. The keynote that Finney sounds again and again in these first few chapters is so low-key pleasant that in less sure hands it would become insipid. Nice. Again and again, Finney returns to that word. Things in Santa Mira, he tells us, are not great, not wild and crazy, not terrible, not boring. Things in Santa Mira are nice. No one here is laboring under that old Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. For the first time, I really saw her face again. I saw it was the same nice face. This from page 9. A few pages later, it was nice out, temperature around 65, and the light was good. Still plenty of sun. Cousin Wilma is also nice, if rather plain. Miles thinks she would have made a good wife and mother, but she just never married. That's how it goes, Miles philosophizes, innocently unaware of any banality. He tells us he wouldn't have believed her the type of woman to have mental problems. But still, you never know. This stuff shouldn't work, and yet somehow it does. We feel that Miles has somehow stepped through the first-person convention and is actually talking to us, just as it seems that Tom Sawyer is actually talking to us in the Twain novel. In Santa Mira, California, as Finney presents it to us, is exactly the sort of town where we would almost expect to see Tom whitewashing a fence. There would be no huck around sleeping in a hogshead, though. Not in Santa Mira. The Body Snatchers is the only Finney book which can rightly be called a horror novel, but Santa Mira, which is a typical nice Finney setting, is the perfect locale for such a tale. Perhaps one horror novel is all that Finney had to write. Certainly it was enough to set the mold for what we now call the modern horror novel. If there is such a thing, there can be no doubt at all that Finney had a large hand in inventing it. I have used the phrase off-key note earlier on, and that is Finney's actual method in The Body Snatchers, I think. One off-key note, then two, then a ripple, then a run of them. Finally, the jagged, discordant music of horror overwhelms the melody entirely. But Finney understands that there is no horror without beauty, no discord without a prior sense of melody, no nasty without nice. There are no plains of Langhir, no cyclopean ruins under the earth, no shambling monsters in the subway tunnels under New York. At about the same time Jack Finney was writing The Body Snatchers, Richard Matheson was writing his classic short story, Born of Man and Woman, the story that begins, "Today my mother called me wretch. You wretch," she said. Between the two of them, they made the break from the Lovecraftian fantasy that had held sway over serious American writers of horror for two decades or more. Matheson's short story was published well before Weird Tales went broke. Finney's novel was published by Dell a year after. Although Matheson published two early short stories in Weird Tales, neither writer is associated with this icon of American fantasy horror magazines. They represent the birth of an almost entirely new breed of American fantasist, just as, in the years 1977 through 1980, the emergence of Ramsey Campbell and Robert Aikman in England may represent another significant turn of the wheel. At the same time Finney and Matheson began administering their own particular brands of shock treatment to the American imagination, Ray Bradbury began to be noticed in the fantasy community, and during the 50s and 60s, Bradbury's name would become the one most readily identified with the genre in the mind of the general reading public. But for me, Bradbury lives and works alone in his own country, and his remarkable iconoclastic style has never been successfully imitated. Vulgarly put, when God made Ray Bradbury, he broke the mold. I have mentioned that Finney's short story, The Third Level, predates Rod Serling's The Twilight Zone series. In exactly the same fashion, Finney's little town of Santa Mira predates and points the way toward Peter Straub's fictional town of Millburn, New York, Thomas Tryon's Cornwall Coombe, Connecticut, and my own little town of Salem's Lot, Maine. It is even possible to see Finney's influence in Blatty's The Exorcist, where foul doings become fouler when set against the backdrop of Georgetown, a suburb which is quiet, graciously rich, and nice. Finney concentrates on sewing a seam between the prosaic reality of his little you-can-see-it-before-your-eyes town and the outright fantasy of the pods which will follow. He sews the seam with such fine stitchwork that when we cross over from the world that really is and into a world of utter make-believe, we are hardly aware of any change. This is a major feat, and like the magician who can make the cards walk effortlessly over the tips of his fingers in apparent defiance of gravity, it looks so easy that you'd be tempted to believe anyone could do it. You see the trick, but not the long hours of practice that went into creating the effect. We have spoken briefly of paranoia in Rosemary's Baby. In The Body Snatchers, the paranoia becomes full, rounded, and complete. If we are all incipient paranoids, if we all take a quick glance down at ourselves when laughter erupts at the cocktail party, just to make sure we're zipped up and it isn't us they're laughing at, then I'd suggest that Finney uses this incipient paranoia quite deliberately to manipulate our emotions in favor of Miles, Becky, and Miles's friends, the Belichicks. Wilma, for instance, can present no proof that her Uncle Ira is no longer her Uncle Ira, but she impresses us with her strong conviction and with a deep, free-floating anxiety as pervasive as a migraine headache. Here is a kind of paranoid dream, as seamless and as perfect as anything out of a Paul Bowles novel or a Joyce Carol Oates tale of the uncanny. Wilma sat staring at me, eyes intense.
"I've been waiting for today," she whispered, "waiting till he'd get a haircut, and he finally did."
Again she leaned toward me, eyes big, her voice a hissing whisper.
"There's a little scar on the back of Ira's neck. He had a boil there once, and your father lanced it. You can't see the scar," she whispered, "when he needs a haircut. But when his neck is shaved, you can. Well, today, I've been waiting for this. Today, he got a haircut."
I sat forward, suddenly excited.
"And the scar's gone? You mean..."
"No,"
she said, almost indignantly, eyes flashing.
"It's there, the scar. Exactly like Uncle Ira's."
So Finney serves notice that we are working here in a world of utter subjectivity and utter paranoia. Of course, we believe Wilma at once, even though we have no real proof, if for no other reason we know from the title of the book that the body snatchers are out there somewhere. By putting us on Wilma's side from the start, Finney has turned us into equivalents of John the Baptist, crying in the wilderness. It is easy enough to see why the book was eagerly seized upon by those who felt, in the early 50s, that there was either a communist conspiracy afoot, or perhaps a fascist conspiracy, that was operating in the name of anti-communism. Because either way, or neither way, this is a book about conspiracy with strong paranoid overtones. In other words, exactly the sort of story to be claimed as political allegory by political loonies of every stripe. Earlier on, I mentioned the idea that perfect paranoia is perfect awareness. To that, we could add that paranoia may be the last defense of the overstrained mind. Much of the literature of the 20th century, from such diverse sources as Bertolt Brecht, Jean-Paul Sartre, Edward Albee, Thomas Hardy, even F. Scott Fitzgerald, has suggested that we live in an existential sort of world, a planless insane asylum where things just happen. "Is God dead?" asks the Time magazine cover in the waiting room of Rosemary Woodhouse's satanic obstetrician. In such a world, it is perfectly credible that a mental defective should sit on the upper floor of a little-used building, wearing a Hanes T-shirt, eating takeout chicken, and waiting to use his mail-order rifle to blow out the brains of an American president. Perfectly possible that another mental defective should be able to stand around in a hotel kitchen a few years later waiting to do exactly the same thing to that defunct president's younger brother. Perfectly understandable that nice American boys from Iowa and California and Delaware should have spent their tours in Vietnam collecting ears, many of them extremely tiny. That the world should begin to move once more toward the brink of an apocalyptic war because of the preachings of an 80-year-old Muslim holy man who is probably fogging on what he had for breakfast by the time sunset rolls around. All of these things are mentally acceptable if we accept the idea that God has abdicated for a long vacation, or has, perchance, really expired. They are mentally acceptable. But our emotions, our spirits, and most of all, our passion for order, these powerful elements of our human makeup, all rebel. If we suggest that there was no reason for the deaths of 6 million Jews in the camps during World War II, no reason for poets bludgeoned, old women raped, children turned into soap, that it just happened and nobody was really responsible, things just got a little out of control here, so sorry, then the mind begins to totter. I saw this happen at first hand in the 60s, at the height of the generational shudder that began with our involvement in Vietnam and went on to encompass everything from parietal hours on college campuses and the voting franchise at 18 to corporate responsibility for environmental pollution. I was in college at the time, attending the University of Maine, and while I began college with political leanings too far to the right to actually become radicalized, by 1968... my mind had been changed forever about a number of fundamental questions. The hero of Jack Finney's later novel, Time and Again, says it better than I could. I was an ordinary person who, long after he was grown, retained the childhood assumption that the people who largely control our lives are somehow better informed than, and have judgment superior to, the rest of us, that they are more intelligent. Not until Vietnam did I finally realize that some of the most important decisions of all time can be made by men knowing really no more than most of the rest of us. For me, it was a nearly overwhelming discovery, one that really began to happen, perhaps, on that day in the Stratford Theater, when the announcement that the Russians had orbited a space satellite was made to me and my contemporaries by a theater manager who looked like he had been gut-shot at close range. But for all of that, I found it impossible to embrace the mushrooming paranoia of the last 4 years of the 60s completely. In 1968, during my junior year at college, three Black Panthers from Boston came to my school and talked, under the auspices of the public lecture series, about how the American business establishment, mostly under the guidance of the Rockefellers and AT&T, was responsible for creating the neo-fascist political state of America, encouraging the war in Vietnam because it was good for business, and also encouraging an ever more virulent climate of racism, statism, and sexism. Johnson was their puppet. Humphrey and Nixon were also their puppets. It was a case of meet the new boss, same as the old boss, as the Who would say a year or two later. The only solution was to take it into the streets. They finished with the Panther slogan, "All power comes out of the barrel of a gun," and adjured us to remember Fred Hampton. Now, I did not and do not believe that the hands of the Rockefellers were utterly clean during that period, nor those of AT&T. I did and do believe that companies like Sikorsky and Douglas Aircraft and Dow Chemical and even the Bank of America subscribed more or less to the idea that war is good business. But never invest your son as long as you can slug the draft board in favor of the right kind of people. When at all possible, feed the war machine the spicks and the niggers and the poor white trash from Appalachia, but not our boys, oh no, never our boys. I did and do believe that the death of Fred Hampton was a case of police manslaughter at the very least, but these Black Panthers were suggesting a huge umbrella of conscious conspiracy that was laughable, except the audience wasn't laughing. During the Q&A period, they were asking sober, concerned questions about just how the conspiracy was working, who was in charge, how they got their orders out, etc. Finally, I got up and said something like, "Are you really suggesting that there is an actual board of fascist conspiracy in this country? That the conspirators, the presidents of GM and SO, plus David and Nelson Rockefeller, are maybe meeting in a big underground chamber beneath the Bonneville salt flats with agendas containing items on how more blacks can be drafted and the war in Southeast Asia prolonged? I was finishing with the suggestion that perhaps these executives were arriving at their underground fortress in flying saucers, thus handily accounting for the upswing in UFO sightings as well as for the war in Vietnam, when the audience began to shout angrily for me to sit down and shut up, which I did post-haste, blushing furiously, knowing how those eccentrics who mount their soapboxes in Hyde Park on Sunday afternoons must feel. I did not much relish the feeling. The Panther who spoke did not respond to my question, which, to be fair, wasn't a question at all, really. He merely said softly, "You got a surprise, didn't you, man?" This was greeted with a burst of applause and laughter from the audience. I did get a surprise, and a pretty unpleasant one at that. But some thought has convinced me that it was impossible for those of my generation, propelled harum-scarum through the 60s, hair flying back from our foreheads, eyes bugging out with a mixture of delight and terror, from the Kingsman doing Louie Louie to the blasting fuzz tones of the Jefferson airplane, to get from point A to point Z without a belief that someone, even Nelson Rockefeller, was pulling the strings. In various ways throughout this book, I've tried to suggest that the horror story is in many ways an optimistic, upbeat experience, that it is often the tough mind's way of coping with terrible problems which may not be supernatural at all, but perfectly real. Paranoia may be the last and strongest bastion of such an optimistic view. It is the mind crying out, "Something rational and understandable is going on here. These things do not just happen." So we look at a shadow and say there was a man on the grassy knoll at Dallas. We say that James Earl Ray was in the pay of certain big Southern business interests, or maybe the CIA. We ignore the fact that American business interests exist in complex circles of power, often revolving in direct opposition to one another, and suggest that our stupid but mostly well-meant involvement in Vietnam was a conspiracy hatched by the military-industrial complex, or that, as a recent rash of badly spelled and printed posters in New York suggested, that the Ayatollah Khomeini is a puppet of, yeah, you guessed it, David Rockefeller. We suggest, in our endless inventiveness, that Captain Mantell did not die of oxygen starvation back there in 1947, while chasing that odd daytime reflection of Venus, which veteran pilots call a sundog. No, he was chasing a ship from another world, which exploded his plane with a death ray when he got too close. It would be wrong of me to leave you with any impression that I am inviting the two of us to have a good laugh at these things together. I am not. These things are not the beliefs of madmen, but the beliefs of sane men and women trying desperately not to preserve the status quo, but just to find the fucking thing. And when Becky Driscoll's cousin Wilma says her Uncle Ira isn't her Uncle Ira, we believe her instinctively and immediately. If we don't believe her, all we've got is a spinster going quietly dotty in a small California town. The idea does not appeal. In a sane world, nice middle-aged ladies like Wilma aren't supposed to go bonkers. It isn't right. There's a whisper of chaos in it that's somehow more scary than believing she might be right about Uncle Ira. We believe because belief affirms the lady's sanity. We believe her because something is going on. All those paranoid fantasies are really not fantasies at all. We and Cousin Wilma are right. It's the world that's gone haywire. The idea that the world has gone haywire is pretty bad, but as we can cope with Bill Nolan's 50-foot bug once we see what it really is, so we can cope with a haywire world if we just know where our feet are planted. Bob Dylan speaks to the existentialist in us when he tells us that something is going on here, but you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? Finney, in the guise of Miles Bunnell, takes us firmly by the arm and tells us that he knows exactly what's going on here. It's those goddamn pods from space. They're responsible. It's fun to trace the classic threads of paranoia Finney weaves into his story. While Miles and Becky are at a movie, Miles's writer friend, Jack Belichick, asks Miles to come and take a look at something he's found in his basement. The something turns out to be the body of a naked man on a pool table. a body which seems to Miles, Becky, Jack, and Jack's wife, Theodora, somehow unformed, not yet quite shaped. It's a pod, of course, and the shape it is taking is Jack's own. Shortly, we have concrete proof that something is terribly wrong.
Becky actually moaned when we saw the fingerprints, and I think we all felt sick.
Because it's one thing to speculate about a body that's never been alive, a blank, but it's something very different, something that touches whatever is primitive deep in your brain, to have that speculation proved. There were no prints. There were five absolutely smooth, solidly black circles. These four, now aware of the pod conspiracy, agree not to call the police immediately, but to see how the pods develop. Miles takes Becky home and then goes home himself, leaving the Belichicks to stand watch over the thing on the pool table. But in the middle of the night, Theodora Belichick freaks out and the two of them show up on Miles' doorstep. Miles calls a psychiatrist friend, Manny Kaufman. A shrink? We are immediately suspicious.
We don't need a shrink here, we want to shout at Miles. Call out the army!
To come and sit with the Belichicks while he goes after Becky, who earlier has confessed to feeling that her father is no longer her father. On the bottom shelf of a cupboard in the Driscoll basement, Miles finds a blank which is developing into a pseudo-Becky. Finney does a brilliant job of describing what this coming-to-being would look like. He compares it to fine stamping medallions, to developing a photograph, and later to those eerie, lifelike South American dolls. But in our current state of high nervousness, what really impresses us is how neatly the thing has been tucked away, hidden behind a closed door in a dusty basement, biding its time. Becky has been drugged by her father, and in a scene simply charged with romance, Miles spirits her out of the house and carries her through the sleeping streets of Santomir in his arms. It is no trick to imagine the gauzy stuff of her nightgown nearly glowing in the moonlight. And the fallout of all this? When Manny Kaufman arrives, the men return to the Belichick house to investigate the basement. There was no body on the table. Under the bright, shadowless light from the overhead lay the brilliant green felt, and on the felt, except at the corners and along the sides, lay a sort of thick gray fluff that might have fallen or been jarred loose, I supposed, from the open rafters. For an instant, his mouth hanging open, Jack stared at the table. Then he swung to Manny, and his voice protesting, asking for belief, he said,
"It was there on the table. Manny, it was!"
Manny smiled, nodding quickly.
"I believe you, Jack."
"But we know that's what all these shrinks say, just before they call for the men in the white coats. We know that fluff isn't just fluff from the overhead rafters. The damn thing has gone to seed. But nobody else knows it." And Jack is quickly reduced to the final plea of the helpless paranoiac.
"You gotta believe me, Doc!"
Manny Kaufman's rationalization for the increasing number of people in Santomir who no longer believe their relatives are their relatives is that Santomirans are undergoing a case of low-key mass hysteria, the sort of thing that may have been behind the Salem witch trials, the mass suicides in Guyana, even the dancing sickness of the Middle Ages. But below this rationalistic approach, existentialism lurks unpleasantly. These things happen, he seems to suggest, just because they happen. Sooner or later, they will work themselves out. They do, too. Mrs. Seeley, who believed her husband wasn't her husband, comes in to tell Miles that everything is fine now. Ditto the girls who were scared of their English instructor for a while. And ditto Cousin Wilma, who calls up Miles to tell him how embarrassed she is at having caused such a fuss. Of course Uncle Ira is Uncle Ira. And in every case, one other fact, a name, stands out. Manny Kaufman was there, helping them all. Something is wrong here, all right, but we know very well what it is, thank you, Mr. Jones. We have noticed the way Kaufman's name keeps cropping up. We're not stupid, right? Damn right we're not.
and it's pretty obvious that Manny Kaufman is now playing for the visiting team.
And one more thing. At Jack Belichick's insistence, Miles finally decides to call a friend in the Pentagon and spill the whole incredible story. About his long-distance call to Washington, Miles tells us,
"It isn't easy explaining a long, complicated story over the telephone, and we had bad luck with the connection. At first I heard Ben and he heard me as clearly as though we were next door to each other. But when I began telling him what had been happening here, the connection faded. Ben had to keep asking me to repeat. I almost had to shout to make him understand me. You can't talk well. You can't even think properly when you have to repeat every other phrase. And I signaled the operator and asked for a better connection. I'd hardly resumed when a sort of buzzing sound started in the receiver in my ear, and then I had to try to talk over that. They, of course, are now in charge of communications coming into and going out of Santa Mira. We are controlling transmission," that somehow frightening voice which introduced the Outer Limits each week used to say. "We will control the horizontal. We will control the vertical. We can roll the image, make it flutter. We can change the focus." Such a passage will also strike a responsive chord in any old anti-war protester, SDS member, or activist who ever believed his or her home phone was tapped, or that the guy with an icon on the edge of the demonstration was taking his or her picture for a dossier someplace. They are everywhere. They are watching. They are listening. Surely it is no wonder that Siegel believed that Finney's novel was about a red under every bed, or that others believed it was about the creeping fascist menace. As we descend deeper and deeper into the whirlpool of this nightmare, it might even become possible to believe it was the pod people who were on the grassy knoll in Dallas, or that it was the pod people who obediently swallowed their poisoned Kool-Aid at Jonestown and then spritzed it down the throats of their squalling infants. It would be such a relief to be able to believe that. Miles's conversation with his army friend is the book's clearest delineation of the paranoid mind at work. Even when you know the whole story, you aren't allowed to communicate it to those in authority, and it's hard to think with that buzzing in your head. Linked to this is the strong sense of xenophobia Finney's major characters feel. The pods really are a threat to our way of life, as Joe McCarthy used to say. "They'll have to declare martial law," Jack tells Miles. "A state of siege or something, anything. And then do whatever has to be done. Root this thing out. Smash it. Crush it. Kill it." Later, during their brief flight from Santa Mira, Miles and Jack discover two pods in the trunk of the car. This is how Miles describes what happens next. "And there they lay, in the advancing, retreating waves of flickering red light. Two enormous pods already burst open in one or two places. And I reached in with both hands and tumbled them out onto the dirt. They were weightless as children's balloons, harsh and dry on my palms and fingers. At the feel of them on my skin, I lost my mind completely, and then I was trampling them, smashing and crushing them under my plunging feet and legs, not even knowing that I was uttering a sort of hoarse, meaningless cry. A fright and animal disgust. No friendly old men holding up signs reading, 'Stop and be friendly here.' Here we have Miles and Jack, mostly out of their minds, doing the funky chicken over these weird and insensate invaders from space. There is no discussion, vis-a-vis the thing, of what we could learn from these things to the benefit of modern science. There is no white flag here, no parley. Finney's aliens are as strange and as ugly as those bloated leeches you sometimes find clinging to your skin after swimming in still ponds. There is no reasoning here, nor any effort to reason, only Miles's blind and primitive reaction to the alien outsider." The book, which most closely resembles Finney's, is Robert A. Heinlein's The Puppet Masters. Like Finney's novel, it is perhaps nominally SF, but is in fact a horror novel. In this one, invaders from Saturn's largest moon, Titan, arrive on Earth, ready, willing, and able to do business. Heinlein's creatures are not pods. They are the leeches in actuality. They are slug-like creatures that ride on the backs of their hosts' necks, the way that you or I might ride a horse.
The two books are similar, strikingly so, in many ways. Heinlein's narrator begins by wondering aloud if they were truly intelligent. He ends after the menace has been defeated. The narrator is one of those building and manning rocket ships aimed at Titan. Now that the tree has been chopped down, they will burn the roots. Death and destruction, the narrator exults, thus ending the book. But what exactly is the threat which the pause in Finney's novel pose? For Finney, the fact that they will mean the end of the human race seems almost secondary. Pod people have no interest in what an old acquaintance of mine likes to refer to as doing the trick. The real horror for Jack Finney seems to be that they threaten all that nice, and I think this is where we came in. On his way to the office, not too long after the pod invasion is well launched, Miles describes the scenery this way. The look of Throckmorton Street depressed me. It seemed littered and shabby in the morning sun. A city trash basket stood heaped and unemptied from the day before. The globe of an overhead streetlight was broken, and a few doors down, a shop stood empty. The windows were whitened, and a clumsily painted "For Rent" sign stood leaning against the glass. It didn't say where to apply, though, and I had a feeling no one cared whether the store was ever rented again. A smashed wine bottle lay in the entranceway of my building, and the brass nameplate set in the gray stone of the building was mottled and unpolished. From Jack Finney's fiercely individualistic point of view, the worst thing about the body snatchers is that they will allow the nice little town of Santa Mira to turn into something resembling a subway station on 42nd Street in New York. Humans, Finney asserts, have a natural drive to create order out of chaos, which fits well enough with the book's paranoid themes. Humans want to improve the universe. These are old-fashioned ideas, perhaps, but Finney is a traditionalist, as Richard Gid Powers points out in his introduction to the Greg Press edition of the novel. From where Finney stands, the scariest thing about the pod people is that chaos doesn't bother them a bit, and they have absolutely no sense of aesthetics. This is not an invasion of roses from outer space, but rather an infestation of ragweed. The pod people are going to mow their lawns for a while and then give it up. They don't give a shit about the crabgrass. They aren't going to be making any trips down to the Santa Mira True Value Hardware so they can turn that musty old basement annex into a rec room in the best do-it-yourself tradition. A salesman who blows into town complains about the state of the roads. If they aren't patched soon, he says, Santa Mira will be cut off from the world. But do you think the pod people are going to lose any sleep over a little thing like that? Here's what Richard Gid Powers says in his introduction about Finney's outlook. With the hindsight afforded by Finney's later books, it is easy to see what the critics overlooked when they interpreted both the book and the movie simply as products of the anti-communist hysteria of the McCarthyite 50s, a know-nothing outburst against alien ways of life that threatened the American way. Miles Bunnell is a precursor of all the other traditionalist heroes of Jack Finney's later books, but in The Body Snatchers, Miles's town of Santa Mira, Marin County, California, still is the unspoiled mythical Gemeinschaft community that later heroes have had to travel through time to recapture. When Miles begins to suspect that his neighbors are no longer real human beings and are no longer capable of sincere human feelings, he is encountering the beginning of the insidious modernization and dehumanization that faces later Finney heroes as an accomplished fact. Miles Bunnell's victory over the pods is fully consistent with the adventures of subsequent Finney characters. His resistance to depersonalization is so fierce that the pods finally give up on their plans for planetary colonization and mosey off to another planet where the inhabitants' hold on their self-integrity is not so strong. Further on, Powers has this to say about the archetypical Finney hero in general and the purposes of this book in particular. Finney's heroes, particularly Miles Bunnell, are all inner-directed individualists in an increasingly other-directed world. Their adventures could be used as classroom illustrations of Tocqueville's theory about the plight of a free individual in a mass democracy. The Body Snatchers is a raw and direct mass-market version of the despair over cultural dehumanization that fills T.S. Eliot's Wasteland and William Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury. Finney adroitly uses the classic science fiction situation of an invasion from outer space to symbolize the annihilation of the free personality in contemporary society. He succeeded in creating the most memorable of all pop cultural images of what Gene Shepard was describing on late-night radio as creeping meatballism. Fields of pods that hatch into identical, spiritless, emotional, vacuous zombies who look so damned much just like you and me. Finally, when we examine the body snatchers in light of the tarot hand we have dealt ourselves, we find in Finney's novel almost every damned card. There is the vampire, for surely those whom the pods have attacked and drained of life have become a modern cultural version of the undead, as Richard Gett Powers points out. There is the werewolf, for certainly these people are not really people at all, and have undergone a terrible sea change. The pods from space, a totally alien invasion of creatures who need no spaceships, can certainly also fit under the heading of the thing without a name. And you might even say, if you wanted to stretch a point, and why the hell not, that citizens of Santa Mira are no more than ghosts of their former selves these days. Not bad legs for a book which is just a story. 6. Ray Bradbury's Something Wicked This Way Comes defies any neat and easy categorization of analysis, and so far, at least, it has also defied the movie makers, in spite of any number of options and scenarios, including Bradbury's own. This novel, originally published in 1962 and promptly given a critical pasting by critics in both the science fiction and fantasy genres, has gone on through 24 printings since its original publication. Not much new in this. Writers in the fantasy and science fiction genres moan about the critical coverage they get from mainstream critics, sometimes with justification, sometimes without. But the fact is, most critics inside the genre are intellectual dorks. The genre magazines have a long and ignoble history of roasting novels which are too large for the genres from which they've come. Robert Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land took a similar pasting. For all of that, it has not been Bradbury's most successful book, or his best-known one. The Martian Chronicles, Fahrenheit 451, and Dandelion Wine have probably all outsold it, and are certainly better known to the general reading public. But I believe that Something Wicked This Way Comes, a darkly poetic tall tale set in the half-real, half-mythical community of Greentown, Illinois, is probably Bradbury's best work, a shadowy descendant from that tradition that has brought us stories about Paul Bunyan and his blue ox, Babe, Pecos Bill, and Davy Crockett. It is not a perfect book. At times, Bradbury lapses into the purple overwriting that has characterized too much of his work in the 70s. Some passages are self-imitative and embarrassingly fulsome. But that is a small part of the total work. In most cases, Bradbury carries his story off with guts and beauty and panache. And it might be worth remembering that Theodore Dreiser, the author of Sister Carrie and An American Tragedy, was, like Bradbury, sometimes his own worst enemy, mostly because Dreiser never knew when to stop. "When you open your mouth, Stevie," my grandfather once said to me in despair, "all your guts fall out." I had no reply to that then, but I suppose if he were alive today, I would reply, "That's because I want to be Theodore Dreiser when I grow up." Well, Dreiser was a great writer, and Bradbury seems to be the fantasy genre's version of Dreiser, although Bradbury's line-by-line writing is better and his touch is lighter. Still, the two of them share a remarkable commonality. On the minus side, both show a tendency to not so much write about a subject as to bulldoze it into the ground, and once so bulldozed, both have a tendency to bludgeon the subject until all signs of movement have ceased. On the plus side, both Dreiser and Bradbury are American naturalists of a dark persuasion, and in a crazy sort of way they seem to bookend Sherwood Anderson, the American champ of naturalism. Both of them wrote of American people living in the heartland, although Dreiser's heartland people come to the city while Bradbury's stay at home. of innocence coming heartbreakingly to experience, although Dreiser's people usually break, while Bradbury's people remain, although changed, whole. And both speak in voices which are uniquely, even startlingly American. Both narrate in a clear English which remains informal while mostly eschewing idiom. When Bradbury lapses occasionally into slang, it startles us so much that he seems almost vulgar. Their voices are unmistakably American voices. The easiest difference to point out, and maybe the most unimportant, is that Dreiser is called a realist, while Bradbury is known as a fantasist. Even worse, Bradbury's paperback publisher insists tiresomely on calling him the world's greatest living science fiction writer, making him sound like one of the freaks in the shows he writes about so often. When Bradbury has never written anything but the most nominal science fiction. Even in his space stories, he is not interested in negative ion drives or relativity converters. There are rockets, he says, in the connected stories which form The Martian Chronicles, R is for Rocket and S is for Space. That is all you need to know, and is, therefore, all I am going to tell you. To this, I would add that if you want to know how the rockets are going to work in any hypothetical future, turn to Larry Niven or Robert Heinlein. If you want literature, stories, to use Jack Finney's word, about what the future might hold, you must go to Ray Bradbury, or perhaps to Kurt Vonnegut. What powers the rockets is popular mechanic stuff. The province of the writer is what powers the people. All that said, it is impossible to talk of Something Wicked This Way Comes, which is most certainly not science fiction, without putting Bradbury's life work in some sort of perspective. His best work, from the beginning, has been his fantasy, and his best fantasy has been his horror stories. As previously mentioned, the best of the early Bradbury was collected in the marvelous Arkham House collection Dark Carnival. No easily obtainable edition of this work, The Dubliners of American Fantasy Fiction, is available. Many of the stories originally published in Dark Carnival can be found in a later collection, The October Country, which is available in paper. Included are such short Bradbury classics of gut-chilling horror as The Jar, The Crowd, and the unforgettable Small Assassin. Other Bradbury stories published in the 40s were so horrible that the author now repudiates them. Some were adapted as comics stories and published, with a younger Bradbury's permission, in the EC Horror Comics. One of these involves an undertaker who performs hideous but curiously moral atrocities upon his clients. For instance, when three old biddies who love to gossip maliciously are killed in an accident, the undertaker chops off their heads and buries these three heads together, mouth to ear and ear to mouth, so they can enjoy a hideous kaffeeklatsch throughout eternity. Of how his own life influenced the writing of Something Wicked This Way Comes, Bradbury says, "Something Wicked This Way Comes sums up my entire life of loving Lon Chaney and the magicians and grotesques he played in the 20s films. My mom took me to see Hunchback in 1923 when I was 3. It marked me forever. Phantom of the Opera when I was 6. Same thing. West of Zanzibar when I was about 8. Magician turns himself into a skeleton in front of black natives. Incredible. The Unholy Three? Ditto. Chaney took over my life. I was a raving film maniac long before I hit my 8th year. I became a full-time magician after seeing Blackstone on stage in Waukegan, my hometown in Upper Illinois, when I was 9. When I was 12, Mr. Electrico in his traveling electric chair arrived with the Dill Brothers sideshows and carnival. That was his real name. I got to know him, sat by the lake shore and talked grand philosophies. He, his small ones, me, my grandiose supersized ones about futures and magic. We corresponded several times. He lived in Cairo, Illinois, and was, he said, a defrocked Presbyterian minister. I wish I could remember his Christian name. But his letters have long since been lost in the years. Those small magic tricks he gave me I still have. Anyway, magic and magicians and Chaney and libraries have filled my life. Libraries are the real birthing places of the universe for me. I lived in my hometown library more than I did at home. I loved it at night, prowling the stacks on my fat panther feet.
All of that went into something wicked, which began as a short story in Weird Tales called Black Ferris in May 1948, and just grew like Topsy. Bradbury has continued to publish fantasy throughout his career, and although the Christian Science Monitor called Something Wicked This Way Comes a nightmarish allegory, Bradbury really settles for allegory only in his science fiction. In his fantasy, his preoccupation has been with theme, character, symbol, and that fantastic rush that comes to the writer of fantasy when he puts the pedal to the metal, yanks back on the steering wheel, and drives his jalopy straight up into the black night of unreality. Bradbury relates it this way. Black Ferris became a screenplay in 1958, the night I saw Gene Kelly's Invitation to the Dance, and so much wanted to work for and with him that I rushed home, finished up an outline of Dark Carnival, its then title, and ran it over to his house. Kelly flipped, said he would direct it, went off to Europe to find money. Never found any. Came back discouraged, gave me back my screen treatment, some 80 pages or more, and told me good luck. I said to hell with it and sat down and spent 2 years off and on finishing Something Wicked. Along the way, I said all and everything, just about, that I would ever want to say about my younger self and how I felt about that terrifying thing, life, and that other terror, death, and the exhilaration of both. But, above all, I did a loving thing without knowing it. I wrote a paean to my father. I didn't realize it until one night in 1965, a few years after the novel had been published. Sleepless, I got up and prowled my library, found the novel, reread certain portions, burst into tears. My father was locked into the novel forever, as the father in the book. I wish he had lived to read himself there and be proud of his bravery in behalf of his loving son. Even writing this, I am touched again to remember with what a burst of joy and agony I found that my dad was there, forever, forever for me anyway, locked on paper, kept in print, and beautiful to behold. I don't know what else to say. I loved every minute of writing it. I took 6 months off between drafts. I never tire myself. I just let my subconscious throw up when it feels like it. I love the book best of all the things I've ever written. I will love it and the people in it, Dad and Mr. Electrico and Will and Jim, the two halves of myself, sorely tired and tempted, until the end of my days. Maybe the first thing we notice in Something Wicked This Way Comes is Bradbury's splitting of those two halves of himself. Will Holloway, the good boy, well, both of them are good, but Will's friend Jim goes astray for a while, is born on October 30, a minute before midnight. Jim Nightshade is born 2 minutes later, a minute past midnight, on Halloween morning. Will is Apollonian, a creature of reason and plan, a believer, mostly, in the status quo and the norm. Jim Nightshade, as his name implies, is the Dionysian half, a creature of emotion, something of a nihilist, hell-bent for destruction, ready to spit in the devil's face just to see if the spittle will steam and sizzle, running down the Dark Lord's cheek. When the lightning rod salesman comes to town at the beginning of Bradbury's fabulous tale, running just ahead of the storm, and tells the boys that lightning will strike Jim's house, Will has to persuade Jim to put the lightning rod up. Jim's initial reaction is, "Why spoil the fun?" The symbolism of the times of birth is large, crude, and apparent. So is the symbolism of the lightning rod salesman, who arrives as a harbinger of bad times. Bradbury pulls it off nonetheless, mostly out of sheer fearlessness. He deals his archetypes large, like those bridge-sized cards. In Bradbury's story, an ancient carnival, marvelously named Cougar and Dark's Pandemonium Shadow Show, arrives in Greentown, bringing misery and horror under the guise of pleasure and wonder. Will Holloway and Jim Nightshade, and later Will's father Charles as well, wise up to exactly what this particular carnival is all about. The tale eventually narrows down to the struggle for a single soul, that of Jim Nightshade. To call it an allegory would be wrong, but to call it a moral horror tale
much in the manner of those EC horror tales which foreran it, would be exactly right. In effect, what happens to Jim and Will is not so much different from Pinocchio's scary encounter on Pleasure Island, where boys who indulge their baser desires, smoking cigars and shooting snooker, for instance, are turned into donkeys. Bradbury, in writing here of carnal enticements, not just sexual carnality, but carnality in its broadest forms and manifestations, the pleasures of the flesh run as wild as the tattooed illustrations which cover Mr. Dark's body. The one reference to sexual carnality here occurs during the business of the theater, which Bradbury declined to discuss in this letter to me, although I asked him if he would be so kind as to elaborate a bit. It remains one of the book's most tantalizing episodes. Jim and Will discover the theater, Bradbury says, on the upper floor of a house while they were monkey-climbing for the sourest apples. Bradbury tells us that looking into the theater changed everything, including the taste of the fruit, and while I have a tendency to bolt at the first stench of graduate school analysis like a horse smelling good water polluted with alkali, the apple and Eden metaphor here is too strong to be denied. What exactly is going on in this second or third floor room, this theater that changed the taste of the apples, that so fascinates Jim of the dark name and his friend, whose Christian name is so associated with our supposed ability, our supposed Christian ability, to consciously command goodness in any given situation? Bradbury suggests that the theater is one room in a whorehouse. The people inside are naked. They let fall clothes to the rug, stood raw and animal-crazy, naked, like shivering horses. If so, it is the book's most telling foreshadowing of the carnal deviation from the norm, which so strongly attracts Jim Nightshade as he stands on the threshold of adolescence. What saves Bradbury's novel from being merely a nightmarish allegory or a simplistic fairy story is its grasp of story and style. Bradbury's style, so attractive to me as an adolescent, now seems a bit oversweet, but it still wields a considerable power. Here is one of the passages which seems oversweet to me. "And Will? Why, he's the last peach high on a summer tree. Some boys walk by and you cry seeing them. They feel good, they look good, they are good. Oh, they're not above peeing off a bridge or stealing an occasional dime store pencil sharpener. It's not that. It's just, you know, seeing them pass, that's how they'll be all their life. They'll get hit, hurt, cut, bruised, and always wonder why. Why does it happen? And one that seems just right. The wails of a lifetime were gathered in that train whistle, from other nights and other slumbering years. The howls of moon-dreamed dogs, the sleep of river-cold winds through January porch screens, which stopped the blood. A thousand fire sirens weeping, or worse, the outgone shreds of breath. The protests of a billion people dead or dying, not wanting to be dead. Their groans, their sighing, burst over the earth."
Man, that's a train whistle, I want to tell you.
More clearly than any other book discussed here, Something Wicked This Way Comes reflects the differences between the Apollonian life and the Dionysian. Bradbury's carnival, which creeps inside the town limits and sets up shop in a meadow at 3 o'clock in the morning, Fitzgerald's Dark Night of the Soul, if you like, is a symbol of everything that is abnormal, mutated, monstrous, Dionysian. I've always wondered if the appeal of the vampire myth for children doesn't lie partly in the simple fact that vampires get to sleep all day and stay up all night. Vampires never have to miss creature features at midnight because of school the next day. Similarly, we know that part of this carnival's attraction for Jim and Will, sure, Will feels its pull too, although not as strongly as his friend Jim feels it. Even Will's father is not entirely immune from its deadly siren song. Is that there will be no set bedtimes, no rules and regulations, no dull and boring small town day after day, no eat your broccoli, think of the people starving in China, no school. The carnival is chaos. It is the taboo land, made magically portable, traveling from place to place, and even from time to time, with its freight of freaks and its glamorous attractions. The boys, sure, Jim too, represent just the opposite. They are normal, not mutated, not monstrous. They live their lives by the rules of the sunlit world, Will willingly, Jim impatiently, which is exactly why the carnival wants them. The essence of evil, Bradbury suggests, is its need to compromise and corrupt that delicate passage from innocence to experience that all children must make. In the rigid moral world of Bradbury's fiction, the freaks who populate the carnival have taken on the outward shapes of their inward vices. Mr. Cougar, who has lived for thousands of years, pays for his life of dark degeneracy by becoming a thing even more ancient, ancient almost beyond our ability to comprehend, kept alive by a steady flow of electricity. The human skeleton is paying for miserliness of feeling, the fat lady for physical or emotional gluttony, the dust witch for her gossipy meddling in the lives of others. The carnival has done to them what the undertaker in that old Bradbury horror story did to his victims after they had died. On its Apollonian side, the book asks us to recall and re-examine the facts and myths of our own childhoods, most specifically our small-town American childhoods. Written in a semi-poetic style that seems to suit such concerns perfectly, Bradbury examines these childhood concerns and comes to the conclusion that only children are equipped to deal with childhood's myths and terrors and exhalations. In his mid-50s story, The Playground, a man who returns magically to childhood is propelled into a world of lunatic horror, which is only, after all, the corner playground with its sandboxes and its slippery slide. In Something Wicked This Way Comes, Bradbury interconnects this small-town American boyhood motif with most of the ideas of the new American Gothic, which we have already discussed to some extent. Will and Jim are essentially okay, essentially Apollonian, riding easy in their childhoods and used to looking at the world from their shorter height. But when their teacher, Miss Foley, returns to childhood, the first of the carnival's Green Town victims, she enters a world of monotonous, unending horror which is not much different from that experienced by the protagonist of The Playground. The boys discover Miss Foley, or what remains of her, under a tree. And there was the little girl, crouched, face buried in her hands, weeping as if the town were gone and the people in it, and herself lost in a terrible woods. And at last Jim came edging up and stood at the edge of the shadow and said, "Who is it? I don't know." But Will felt tears start to his eyes, as if some part of him guessed.
"It's not Jenny Holdridge, is it?"
"No."
"Jane Franklin?"
"No." His mouth felt full of Novocaine, his tongue merely stirred in his numb lips.
"No."
The little girl wept, feeling them near, but not looking up yet.
"Me? Help me. Nobody'll help me. Me. I don't like this. Somebody must help me. Someone must help her."
She mourned as for one dead.
"Someone must help her. Nobody will. Nobody has. Terrible. Terrible."
The carnival attraction which has accomplished this malign trick is one that both Narcissus and Eleanor Vance could relate to. Miss Foley has been trapped in the carnival's mirror maze, imprisoned by her own reflection. 40 or 50 years have been jerked out from under her, and she has been tumbled back into her own childhood, just what she thought she wanted. She had not considered the possibility of the nameless little girl weeping under the tree. Jim and Will avoid this fate, barely, and even manage to rescue Miss Foley on her first foray into the mirror maze. One supposes it is not the maze itself, but the carousel that has actually accomplished her doubling back in time. The mirrors in the maze show you a time of life you think you'd like to have again, and the carousel actually accomplishes it. The carousel can add a year to your age each time you go around forward, or make you a year younger for every circle you make on it going backward. The carousel is Bradbury's interesting and workable metaphor for all of life's passages, and the fact that he darkens this ride, which is often associated with the sunniest pleasure we know as children, to fit the motif of this particular black carnival, causes other uneasy associations to come to mind. When we see the innocent merry-go-round with its prancing horses in this nether light, it may suggest to us that if time's passages are to be compared to a merry-go-round ride, then we see that each year's revolution is essentially the same as the last. It perhaps causes us to remember how fleeting and ephemeral such a ride is, and most of all it reminds us that the brass ring, which we have all tried so hard and fruitlessly to catch, is kept deliberately, tauntingly, out of reach. In terms of the new American Gothic, we can see that the mirror maze is the catch-trap, the place where too much self-examination and morbid introspection persuades Miss Foley to step over the line into abnormality. In Bradbury's world, the world of Cougar and Dark's Pandemonium Shadow Show, there are no options. First caught in the glass of Narcissus, you then find yourself riding a dangerous carousel charger backwards into an untenable past, or forward into an untenable future. Shirley Jackson uses the conventions of the New American Gothic to examine character under extreme psychological or perhaps occult pressure. Peter Straub uses them to examine the effects of an evil past upon the present. Ann Rivers Siddons uses them to examine social codes and social pressures. Bradbury uses these self-same conventions in order to offer us a moral judgment. In describing Miss Foley's terror and grief in attaining the childhood she so desired, Bradbury goes far toward diffusing the potential flood of sticky-sweet romanticism that might have destroyed his tale, and I think this diffusing reinforces the moral judgments he makes. In spite of imagery that sometimes swamps us instead of uplifting us, he manages to retain his own clear point of view. This isn't to say Bradbury doesn't make a romantic myth of childhood, because he sure does. Childhood itself is a myth for almost all of us. We think we remember what happened to us when we were kids, but we don't. The reason is simple. We were crazy then. Looking back into this well of sanity as adults who are, if not totally insane, then at least neurotic instead of out-and-out psychotic, we attempt to make sense of things which made no sense, read importance into things which had no importance, and remember motivations which simply didn't exist. This is where the process of myth-making begins. The only novels I can think of that avoid making childhood into a myth or a fairy tale and still succeed wonderfully as stories are William Golding's Lord of the Flies and A High Wind in Jamaica by Richard Hughes. Someone will write me a letter and suggest that I should have added either Ian McEwan's The Cement Garden or Beryl Bainbridge's Harriet Said, but I think that in their differing ways but uniquely British outlook, both of these short novels romanticized childhood as thoroughly as Bradbury ever did. Rather than trying to row against this strong current, as Golding and Hughes do, Bradbury uses it in Something Wicked This Way Comes, blending the myth of childhood with the myth of the dream father, whose part is played here by Will's dad, Charles Halloway, and, if Bradbury himself is to be believed, who is also played by that Illinois power linesman who was Ray Bradbury's dad. Halloway is a librarian who lives his own life of dreams, who is enough boy to understand Will and Jim, but who is also enough adult to provide, in the end, what the boys cannot provide for themselves, that final ingredient in our perception of Apollonian morality, normality, and rectitude, simple accountability. Childhood is the time, Bradbury insists, when you are still able to believe in things you know cannot be true.
"It's not true anyway," Will gasped. "Carnivals don't come this late in the year. Silly darn-sounding thing. Who'd go to it?"
"Me."
Jim stood quiet in the dark.
"Me," thought Will. Seeing the guillotine flash, the Egyptian mirrors unfold accordions of light, and the sulfur-skinned devil man sipping lava like gunpowder tea.
They simply believe. Their hearts are still capable of overruling their heads. They are still sure that they will be able to sell enough boxes of greeting cards or tins of Cloverine salve to get a bike or a stereo, that the toy will really do all the things you saw it do on TV, and that you can put it together in just a matter of minutes with a few simple tools, or that the monster picture going on inside the theater will be as scary and wonderful as the posters and stills outside. That's okay. In Bradbury's world, the myth is ultimately stronger than the reality, and the heart stronger than the head. Will and Jim stand revealed, not as the sordid, dirty, frightened boys of Lord of the Flies, but as creatures built almost entirely of myth, a dream of childhood, which becomes more believable than reality in Bradbury's hand. Through noon after noon, they had screamed up half the rides, knocked over dirty milk bottles, smashed Cupid doll winning plates, smelling, listening, looking their way through the autumn crowd, trampling the leafy sawdust. Where do they come by the wherewithal for their day at the fair? Most kids in a similar situation have to count their finances, and then go through an agonizing process of picking and choosing. Jim and Will apparently do everything. But once again, it's okay. They are our representatives in the forgotten land of childhood, and their apparently endless supply of cash, plus their dead-eye aim at the china plates and pyramids of milk bottles, are accepted with delight and little or no rational hesitation. We believe, as we once believed, that Pecos Bill dug the Grand Canyon one day when he came home tired, thus dragging his pick and shovel behind him instead of carrying them over his shoulder. They are in terror. But it is the unique ability of these myth children to enjoy their terror. They both stop to enjoy the swift pound of each other's heart, Bradbury relates. Cougar and Dark become Bradbury's myth of evil, threatening these children not as gangsters or kidnappers or any realistic bad guys. Cougar is more like Old Pew returned from Treasure Island, his blindness exchanged for a hideous fall of years that has been dropped upon him when the carousel goes wild. When he hisses at Will and Jim, "A short, sad life for you both," we feel the sort of comfortable chill we felt when the black spot was first passed at the Admiral Benbow. They're hiding from the emissaries of the carnival who come into town looking for them under the pretense of a free parade, becomes Bradbury's best summation of this childhood remembered in myth. The childhood that might really have existed in short bursts between long stretches of boredom and such cheesy chores as carrying wood, doing dishes, putting out the trash, or sitting baby brother or sister. And it's probably significant to this idea of the dream child that both Jim and Will are only children. They hid in old garages, they hid in old barns, in the highest trees they could climb, and got bored. And boredom was worse than fear, so they came down and reported into the police chief, and had a fine chat which gave them 20 safe minutes right in the station. And Will got the idea of touring churches, and they climbed all the steeples in town and scared pigeons off the belfries. But there again they began to get starchy with boredom and fatigued with sameness, and were almost on the point of giving themselves up to the carnival in order to have something to do when, quite fortunately, the sun went down. The only effective foil for Bradbury's dream children is Charles Halloway, the dream father. In the character of Charles Halloway we find attractions which only fantasy with its strong myth-making abilities can give us. 3 points about him are worth mentioning, I think. First, Charles Halloway understands the myth of childhood the two boys are living. For all of us who grew up and parted with some bitterness from our parents because we felt they didn't understand our youth, Bradbury gives us a portrait of the sort of parent we felt we deserved. His reactions are those which few real parents can ever afford to have. His parenting instincts are apparently supernaturally alert. Early on, he sees the boys running home from watching the carnival set up, and calls their names softly under his breath, but does no more. Nor does he mention it to Will later, although the two boys have been out at 3 o'clock in the morning. He's not worried that they've been out scoring dope, or mugging old ladies, or stooping their girlfriends. He knows They had been out on boys' business, walking the night, as boys sometimes will, and he lets it go. Second, Charles Holloway comes by his understanding legitimately. He is still living the myth himself. Your father cannot be your pal very successfully, the psychology texts tell us, but there are few fathers, I think, who have not longed to be buddies with their sons, and few sons who have not wished for a buddy in their fathers. When Charles Holloway discovers that Jim and Will have nailed rungs under the climbing ivy on their respective houses so they can escape and re-enter their bedrooms after bedtime, he does not demand that the rungs be torn down. His response is admiring laughter and an admonition that the boys not use the rungs unless they really have to. When Will tells his father in agony that no one will believe them if they try to explain what really happened in Miss Foley's house, where the evil nephew Robert, who is really Mr. Cougar, looking much younger since he has been reissued, framed them for a robbery, Holloway says simply, "I'll believe." He will believe, because he is really just one of the boys, and the sense of wonder has not died within him. Much later, while rummaging through his pockets, Charles Holloway almost seems like the world's oldest Tom Sawyer. And Will's father stood up, stuffed his pipe with tobacco, rummaged his pockets for matches, brought out a battered harmonica, a penknife, a cigarette lighter that wouldn't work, and a memo pad he had always meant to write great thoughts down on, but had never got around to. Almost everything, in fact, except a dead rat and a string to swing it on. Third, Charles Holloway is the dream father because he is, in the end, accountable. He can switch hats in the blink of an eye, from that of the child to that of the adult. He proves his accountability and responsibility by a simple, symbolic act. When Mr. Dark asks, Holloway gives him his name.
"A fine day to you, sir."
"No, Dad," thought Will.
The illustrated man came back.
"Your name, sir?"
he asked directly.
"Don't tell him," thought Will.
Will's father debated a moment, took the cigar from his mouth, tapped ash, and said quietly,
"Holloway, work in the library. Drop by sometime."
"You can be sure, Mr. Holloway, I will."
Holloway was also gazing with surprise at himself, accepting the surprise, the new purpose, which was half despair, half serenity, now that the incredible deed was done. But no one asked why he had given his true name. Even he could not essay and give its real weight. But isn't it most likely that he has given his true name because the boys cannot? He must front for them, which he does admirably. And when Jim's dark wishes finally lead him into what seems utter ruin, it is Holloway who emerges, first destroying the fearsome Dust Witch, then Mr. Dark himself, and finally leading the fight for Jim's life and soul. Something Wicked This Way Comes is probably not Bradbury's best work overall. I believe he has always found the novel a difficult form to work in, but its mythic interests are so well suited to Bradbury's dreamy, semi-poetic prose that it succeeds wonderfully and becomes one of those books about childhood, like Hughes's A High Wind in Jamaica, Stevenson's Treasure Island, Cormier's The Chocolate War, and Thomas Williams's Tsuga's Children, to name just a few, that adults should take down once in a while, not just to give to their own children, but in order to touch base again themselves with childhood's brighter perspectives and darker dreams. Bradbury has introduced his novel with a quotation from Yeats, "Man is in love, and loves what vanishes." He adds others, but we will perhaps agree that the line from Yeats is text enough. But let Bradbury himself have the final word concerning one of Greentown's fascinations for the two dream children of whom he has written. "As for my gravestone, I would like to borrow that great barber pole from out front of the town shop and have it run at midnight if you happen to drop by my mound to say hello. And there the old barber pole would be, lit, its bright ribbons twining up out of mystery, turning and twining away up into further mysteries, forever. And if you come to visit, leave an apple for the ghosts. An apple, or maybe a dead rat, and a string to swing it on. 7. Richard Matheson's The Shrinking Man, 1956, is another case of a fantasy novel packaged as science fiction in a rationalistic decade when even dreams had to have some sort of basis in reality, and this mislabeling of the book has continued right up to the present, for no good reason other than this is how publishers do things. "One of the most incredible science fiction classics of all time," booms the cover of the recent Berkeley reissue, ignoring the fact that a story in which a man shrinks at the steady rate of 1/7 of an inch a day has really gone beyond even the furthest realms of science fiction. Matheson, like Bradbury, has no real interest in hard science fiction. He brings forth an obligatory amount of mumbo-jumbo. My favorite is when a doctor exclaims over Scott Carey's incredible catabolism and then drops it. We know that the process, which eventually results in Scott Carey's being chased through his own basement by a black widow spider, begins when he is doused by a curtain of sparkling radioactive spray. The radioactivity interacts with some bug spray he had ingested into his system a few days earlier. It is this double play that has caused the shrinking process to begin. It is the most minimal nod at rationality, a mid-20th century version of pentagrams, mystic passes, and evil spells. Luckily for us, Matheson, like Bradbury, is more interested in Scott Carey's heart and mind than in his incredible catabolism. It's worth noting that in The Shrinking Man we're back to the old radioactive blues again, and to the idea that horror fiction helps us to externalize in symbolic form whatever is really troubling us. It is impossible to see The Shrinking Man separated from its background of A-bomb tests, ICBMs, the missile gap, and strontium 90 in the milk. If we look at it this way, Matheson's novel, his second published book, according to John Brosnan and John Clute, who collaborated on Matheson's entry in the Science Fiction Encyclopedia, citing Matheson's I Am Legend as the first, I believe they may have overlooked two other Richard Matheson novels, Someone Is Bleeding and Fury on Sunday. Is no more science fiction than such big bug movies as The Deadly Mantis or Beginning of the End. But Matheson is doing more in The Shrinking Man than having radioactive nightmares. The title of Matheson's novel alone suggests bad dreams of a more Freudian nature. Concerning the body snatchers, we'll remember Richard Gid Powers saying that Miles Bennell's victory over the pods is a direct result of Miles' resistance against depersonalization, his fierce individualism, and his defense of more traditional American values. These same things can be said about the Matheson novel, with one important variation. Nor is this the only time that these two very different writers have taken up a similar theme. Both have written time travel stories of men who are driven to escape a terrible present for a friendlier past. Finney's Time and Again, 1970, in which the hero returns to turn-of-the-century times on America's East Coast, and Matheson's Bid Time Return, 1975, in which the hero returns to turn-of-the-century times on America's West Coast. In both cases, their desire to escape what Powers calls cultural depersonalization is a factor, but more different treatments of the idea, and different outcomes, cannot be imagined. It seems to me that while Powers is right in suggesting that The Body Snatchers is in large part about the depersonalization, even the annihilation of the free personality in our society, The Shrinking Man is a story about the free personality's loss of power and growing impotency in a world increasingly controlled by machines, red tape, and a balance of terror where future wars are planned, with one eye always cocked toward an acceptable kill ratio. In Scott Carey, we see one of the most inspired and original symbols of this modern devaluation of human currency ever created. Carey muses at one point that he is not shrinking at all, that instead the world is growing larger. But seen either way, devaluation of the individual or inflation of the environment, the result is the same. As Scott shrinks, he retains his essential individuality but gradually loses more and more control over his world anyway. Also like Finney, Matheson sees his work as just a story, and one he is not even particularly in touch with anymore. His comments, "I started working on the book in 1955. It was the only book I ever wrote back east, if you exclude a novel I wrote when I was 16 and living in Brooklyn. Things had been going badly out here in California, and I thought it might be a good idea to be back east and close to editors for the sake of my career. I had given up on the idea of getting into movies. Actually, there was nothing rational in the move. I was just fed up out here on the coast and talked myself into going back east. My family was there. My brother had a business there, and I knew I could get some work for us to live on if I couldn't sell any writing." In The Shrinking Man, Scott Carey's life becomes an ever louder, ever more discordant medley of anxieties. One of the greatest is the shrinking money supply and his inability to support his family as he always has. I won't say that Matheson has done anything so simple as transferring his own feelings at the time to his character, but I will suggest that perhaps Matheson's own frustrations at the time enabled him to write Carey's character that much more convincingly. "So we went. We were renting a house at Sound Beach on Long Island when I wrote the book. I'd gotten the idea several years earlier while attending a movie in a Redondo Beach theater. It was a silly comedy with Ray Milland and Jane Wyman and Aldo Ray, and in this particular scene, Ray Milland, leaving Jane's apartment in a huff, accidentally put on Aldo Ray's hat, which sank down around his ears. Something in me asked, what would happen if a man put on a hat which he knew was his and the same thing happened? Thus the notion came. The entire novel was written in the cellar of the rented house on Long Island. I did a shrewd thing in that. I didn't alter the cellar at all. There was a rocking chair down there, and every morning I would go down into the cellar with my pad and pencil, and I would imagine what my hero was up to that day." Matheson's hero, Scott Carey, also goes down into the cellar every day with his pad and pencil. He, too, is writing a book. These days, isn't everybody? Scott's book is about his experiences as the world's only shrinking man, and it provides for his family quite adequately, as Matheson's own book and the subsequent film made from it did for Matheson's own family, one supposes. I didn't have to keep the environment in my mind or keep notes. I had it all there, frozen. It was intriguing, when I watched them shoot the film, to see the cellar set, because it reminded me a good deal of the cellar in Sound Beach, and I had a momentary, enjoyable sense of déjà vu. It took me about 2.5 months to write the novel. I originally used the structure the movie did, starting with the beginning of the shrinking process. This didn't work, as it took too long to get to the good stuff, so I recast the storyline to get the reader into the cellar immediately. Recently, when I thought they were going to do a remake of the film, and I thought they wanted me to do it, I decided I would revert to the original structure because in the film, as in my original manuscript, the good stuff took a while to get to. But it turned out they were going to make it into a comedy with Lily Tomlin, and I wasn't going to write it anyway. John Landis was going to direct it at the time, and he wanted all the science fantasy people out here to play minor parts in the film. He wanted me to play a pharmacist who won't give a prescription to Lily Tomlin, who was so small at the time, that she is sitting on the shoulder of an intelligent gorilla. Shows you how they changed the original idea. I demurred. As a matter of fact, the opening of the script is almost like my original one to the point of actual dialogue. Later, it deviates wildly. I don't think the book means anything to me at this time. None of my work does from this distant past. I think I prefer I Am Legend if I had to choose, but they are both too far from me to have any significance in particular. Accordingly, I wouldn't change anything about The Shrinking Man. It is a part of my history. I have no reason to change it, only to look at it without much interest and be pleased at whatever stir it made. I just read the first story I ever sold the other day, Born of Man and Woman, and I cannot relate to the story at all. I remember writing certain phrases, but it was someone else who wrote them. I'm sure you feel that way about the early stuff you wrote. As a matter of fact, I do. My first novel, Carrie, was written under difficult personal circumstances, and the book dealt with characters so unpleasant and so alien to my own outlook as to seem almost like Martians. When I pick up the book now, which is seldom, it does not seem as if someone else had written it, but I do get a peculiar sort of feeling from it. as if I had written it while suffering from a bad case of mental and emotional flu. The Shrinking Man only recently had a hardcover edition. Now it is being printed by the Science Fiction Book Club, too. Up to then, it was strictly softcover. Actually, I Am Legend is much more science fiction than The Shrinking Man. It has a lot of research in it. The science in The Shrinking Man is strictly gobbledygook. Well, I did some asking around and reading, but I hardly had a great rationale for Scott Carey's shrinking. And I winced daily that I made him shrink 1/7 of an inch a day, instead of geometrically, and that I had him worry about falling from heights when it wouldn't have hurt him. Well, to hell with it. I wouldn't have written Born of Man Woman a few years later either, because it is so illogical. What difference does it make, really? As I said, I enjoyed writing the book, because I was like Scott Carey's Boswell, watching him each day as he made his way around the cellar. I had a piece of cake with my coffee the first few days of writing, and I laid it on the shelf, and soon it became a part of the story. I think that some of the incidents during his shrinking period are pretty good. The man who picks him up when he hitchhikes, the midget, the boys chasing him, his deteriorating marriage relationship. A summary of The Shrinking Man is easy to render if we view it in the linear fashion Matheson suggests. After going through the sparkling cloud of radioactivity, Carey begins to lose 1/7 of an inch a day, or roughly 1 foot per season. As Matheson suggests, this smacks of expediency, but as he also suggests, what does it matter as long as we realize that this is not hard science fiction, and that it bears no resemblance to novels and stories by writers such as Arthur C. Clarke, Isaac Asimov, or Larry Niven? It is not exactly sensible that the children in the C.S. Lewis tale should be able to reach another world by going through a bedroom closet either, but that is exactly what happens in the Narnia stories. It is not the technicalities of shrinking that we are interested in, and the inch-per-week pattern at least enables us to keep our own mental yardstick on Scott Carey. We are given Scott's adventures in flashbacks as he shrinks. The main action takes place in what Scott assumes is his last week of life, as he shrinks from 1 inch down to nothing. He has gotten trapped in the cellar while trying to escape his own house cat and a garden sparrow. There's something particularly chilling in Scott's desperate duel with Puss. Does anyone have the slightest doubt about what would happen if we were suddenly changed to a height of 7 inches tall by malign magic, and yon kitty curled up by the fire woke up and happened to see us skittering across the floor? Cats, those amoral gunslingers of the animal world, are maybe the scariest mammals going.